You're listening to The Sound Off. The Sound Off. With the Solomonster. Solomonster.
The Brahma Bull, ever defiant, standing as tall as Andre the Giant.
What did we just see?
Welcome to episode 154 of The Sound Off here on SEScoops.com, post-WrestleMania edition. It is Sunday, April 10th, 2011. I am the Solomonster, and got a lot to get to this week, not going to lie. Got a lot of thoughts on WrestleMania in the books. Of course, the WWE Hall of Fame, Monday Night Raw, the premiere edition of Tough Enough on USA, which I actually rather enjoyed. And then we'll kind of segue into some of the other news stories of the week and the weekend. I got some things to say about Kurt Angle, Scott Hall, Super Schmuck Billy Graham, and a couple of others to get to as well. So let's start off with WrestleMania. WrestleMania 27, of course, emanating 1 week ago. It's already a week in the books from the Georgia Dome in Atlanta. A sellout turnaway crowd of over 71,000, or so they claimed, in attendance. First things first, I want to actually thank all the people who visited SEScoops.com last Sunday. If you were watching the pay-per-view or if you were not watching the pay-per-view, I know we had very heavy traffic on the site for really WrestleMania coverage all weekend, and that includes Sunday night for the live coverage that I anchored on the website for the first time. It was fun. I enjoyed that very much. So if you were one of the people to stop by, maybe leave some comments and follow along, I thank you very much. On Twitter, before the pay-per-view last weekend, I posted a message that said, "Houston, we had a problem 10 years ago today. The greatest top-to-bottom WrestleMania of all time. Can this Sunday top it?" I posted that on April 1st, 2 days before WrestleMania, because, of course, April 1st is the anniversary of WrestleMania 17, which, in my opinion, was certainly one of the, if not the greatest WrestleMania card top to bottom of all time. And the question was, could WrestleMania here in 2011 come close to WrestleMania 17 or perhaps even top that show? In my head, I think I knew that probably wasn't going to happen. But basically, could they overachieve last Sunday? There were a lot of people that sent me emails that were very unenthusiastic about the show, and maybe they weren't big fans of the whole Rock John Cena thing, but whatever it was, a lot of people skeptical about how good of a show WrestleMania would actually be. And I've been getting messages all week long asking me for my thoughts. I haven't posted anything about it. What did I think of WrestleMania? First of all, the most important thing is what you thought of WrestleMania. I know many of you order the show, and on my Facebook and whatnot, you voiced your opinions. There was a lot of displeasure, more displeasure, I think, than I was expecting. After the show went off the air about that pay-per-view, people just completely berating it and bitching and moaning, and there were things to bitch about, but the best thing I could say about it is this. I actually, believe it or not, enjoyed the Elimination Chamber pay-per-view in February more than I did WrestleMania. And that's not to say that I didn't like WrestleMania. Not to say that there wasn't some good stuff on the show, because there absolutely was, and I'll get to all that match by match. But overall, my interpretation of WrestleMania this year, if I had to sum it up in one word, would be underwhelming. I don't think I went into the show with elevated expectations. I was excited for it. I even said that before. I was actually genuinely excited to sit down and watch this pay-per-view. And there were things that they did that were cool, that I liked. There was some good action. But it felt like there was something missing. You know, you had the pomp and the pageantry and the big crowd and the wide shots, and it felt special. They always do a very good job of making WrestleMania feel like a special event. That is truly the biggest event of the year. And this year was no exception to that. I thought the setup, the stage, was just top-notch. In fact, I really liked that stage that they had. I just really thought it was cool, the whole aisleway down to the ring with the WrestleMania logo emblazoned down the aisleway. I just thought that was really cool. The giant screens, I think they had two of them, that were up in the Georgia Dome in the upper decks. It's these long screens. It kind of reminded me of the screens at the Sky Dome for WrestleMania 6 I thought that was really very cool. And WWE always does a fantastic job with that. But again, top to bottom, when the show was over and the credits rolled, I felt like there was something missing. I felt like I was left waiting for more at the end of the show with The Rock, Cena, Miz stuff. Certain things got cut from the show due to time constraints and Vince McMahon changing his mind 1,000 times. Hardly any of the matches were given any real length of time except for Undertaker Triple H. So if I had to rank this pay-per-view on a scale of 1 to 10, I would probably settle it around a 6.5. I would say 6.5 out of 10 for WrestleMania 27. I didn't hate the show. I didn't love the show. It's almost like my WrestleMania 25 review from 2 years ago, which I listened to recently, just to go back. I was just curious about my thoughts on some of the more recent WrestleManias. And my basic analysis of that show was it wasn't the worst WrestleMania of all time, but it wasn't the best WrestleMania of all time. And in fact, it's very much like WrestleMania 25, in that not only was it not the best, not the worst, kind of middle of the road, but it was really highlighted by just one fantastic, legendary match. 2 years ago, of course, it was the first Shawn Michaels-Undertaker WrestleMania match, which is still, hands down, one of my all-time favorite matches. And this year, Undertaker Triple H took those honors. And I give kudos to both those guys because I was not sure that they could pull something like that off. Some people actually hated the match, which I cannot understand what planet they are from. I thought it was a fantastic match. And again, I'll do this breakdown match by match in a second. A couple of other notes here. No title changes this year at WrestleMania. First time ever in the history of the event there were no title changes. Now, of course, to put that in perspective, there were only two title matches on the entire show. Of course, the WWE title and the World Heavyweight title. There was no tag title match. There were no secondary belts on the line. There was no Divas Championship match. And if you ever needed evidence of titles meaning as little as they do now, you've got your biggest show of the year with only two titles at stake out of the seemingly half a dozen that you have in your company. One of which is for the world title in the Curtain Jerker, the opening match. And you bump a promoted title match, that of course being the U.S. title match, off the show at the very last minute. I mean, that Sheamus-Daniel Bryan match up until a few hours before showtime, if that, was still scheduled to be on the show. And of course, at the last minute, that did not happen. So that just gives you a sense of how much reshuffling was going on right up until showtime a week ago at WrestleMania. Tons of internal, apparently, second-guessing within the company of some of the things that were done at the pay-per-view as well. Basically, all the things that a lot of the fans were critical of. The Rock, Cena, Miz ending at the end of the show. The Jerry Lawler, Michael Cole match. A lot of that stuff was the same thing that people inside the company have been complaining about. So you are not alone if you came away from that pay-per-view feeling that, for example, the Michael Cole beatdown of Jerry Lawler went on for fucking ever. Way longer than it ever should have. Or that there should have been something more, some greater interaction between The Rock and John Cena at the end of that show. People in WWE felt the same way. And at the end of the day, the buck stops with Vince McMahon. He's the one who makes the final decisions and calls the shots. So you can lay that at his feet. So let's take this match by match here. And I don't think I've ever actually assigned a star rating when I've done these reviews. I'm not the biggest fan of star ratings since they're so subjective. And I don't know if Dave Meltzer or Wade Keller, whoever it was the first person to ever do star ratings. Now everybody seemingly does them. So I figured, what the fuck, why don't I do them as well? So I'll just give you a sense for each match here. Sheamus and Daniel Bryan again got bumped off the show, which just sucks for them. Daniel Bryan did this video with WWE.com that they put up before the show when he thought he was going to actually be on the pay-per-view. It was going to be his very first WrestleMania. He was very excited about it. And he still got to wrestle technically at WrestleMania in the Georgia Dome, 71,000 people, probably the biggest crowd he's ever competed in front of ever. But it had to suck for him to just be bumped off like he was nothing. It was an embarrassment, quite frankly. And what made it a bigger embarrassment, you know, it would have been one thing if you lay the show out and you realize, holy shit, 4 hours is not enough time. we got to bump something off the show. Let's bump this match. I mean, that would be one thing. Shit happens. But not only did they bump this match off the show, but in the middle of the match, apparently, it turned into a battle royal. Just out of nowhere. It was a lumberjack match, and it just ended up turning into an over-the-top rope battle royal that, of all people, the great Khali came away from as the winner. Yeah, that sucks right there. So yeah, Great Khali wins the Battle Royal. I don't know that anybody really gives a shit about that. A lot of angry people, apparently, who went to WrestleMania in the Georgia Dome. Very pissed off about that. So, the show starts, The Rock comes out, gets a big reaction. You know, one of the things that I noticed when I was watching the pay-per-view also on TV, and certain people complained about this, was the crowd seemed dead. A lot of people complaining, Solomon said the crowd sounded really low. Was it just me, or did it sound like they were not into things? There were certain things on the show the crowd was not into. You know, Webmaster Mike and Noah Mark were at the Georgia Dome for WrestleMania. They posted a ton of great photos, by the way, which if you haven't seen, you should go on to the SC Scoops fan page on Facebook or go to the website and check it out. Really cool stuff. And Mike even said that there were some things during the show that the crowd was dead for because they just weren't into it. But I think by and large, when you have a big stadium show like this, and we've talked about this before, you've got all that extra space, and crowd reactions are going to be very different, and they're going to come across a lot differently, quite frankly, than they would if they were in a 20,000-seat arena. And it can hurt the show. If you're there live, people said that when The Rock came out at the beginning of the pay-per-view, it was a monster reaction. And it seemed like he was getting a lot, you know, a pretty good reaction, but watching it from my perspective at home, one of my first thoughts was, well, that seems like a bit of an underwhelming reaction for The Rock. But apparently the people in the actual building said that they blew the roof off the place. So it just goes to show you that the influence that the building itself can have on one's level of enjoyment of the pay-per-view. But Rock came out, did every single kind of Rock promo you've ever seen before. He was very good at it. But I just couldn't help watching this and a lot of the other segments on the show thinking they could have fit another match in here. So the first match of the night, Edge and Alberto Del Rio for the World Heavyweight Championship, the first time a world title of any kind has opened a WrestleMania pay-per-view show. And Alberto's been saying for months, especially since he won the Royal Rumble, that it was his destiny to go to WrestleMania and come away as the World Heavyweight Champion. And apparently that was the plan for quite a while, although I'm sure that weeks before the show, nobody thought this would be opening the show. Now, I still think that, you know, they could have done a title change here at the beginning of the show, especially since they ended up not doing one at the end of the show, but they obviously had different ideas here. And Edge won clean. I mean, Christian was on the outside. Brodus Clay was on the outside. He attempted interference at one point. And Christian cut him off. Edge delivered a spear to Del Rio, who couldn't quite lock in the cross arm bar. Pinfall, 1-2-3. That was it. And then after the match, Edge and Christian destroyed Del Rio's $100,000-plus automobile that he had driven out onto the stage. A beautiful car. And I'm not a big car guy. I have a friend of mine who's he's really into cars. So I'm sure that if he would have seen this, he would have been in tears. I'm not even a big car guy, and when Edge started keying that car, my heart just sank. I mean, just to destroy a perfectly good vehicle like that for no good reason, it's not even like they did that much damage. They didn't, like, blow the thing up or anything. I mean, did you really have to go ahead and do that? That's not cool. Anyway, I would give this, you know, a 3-star match. I thought it was a pretty good match. I was just very surprised that Del Rio did not go over here. You know, they're going to do a rematch, of course, at Extreme Rules. It'll be a ladder match between Edge and Del Rio. And I'm sure at some point Del Rio's getting the belt. They're not going to beat him at every turn. They've got big hopes for him. He's been pushed a lot better than any other newcomer I've seen in a long, long time. And we'll see what happens. But this was 3 stars. It was fine. It was probably the second or third best match on the entire show, which is not necessarily saying much, but nonetheless, it was a good match. And Edge, who has not had a lot of luck at WrestleMania before as a single star, finally gets a clean pinfall win under his belt and retains the title. Rey Mysterio and Cody Rhodes One-on-one, of course, I've said before, Mysterio hand-picked Cody for this match. He likes him a lot. He sees big things in him. And he was probably right in figuring that if he didn't spring for a match with Cody at WrestleMania, Cody probably would have been off the show, or he would have been one of those lumberjacks in the opening Battle Royals. So, I hope Cody personally thanked Mysterio for this opportunity, because not only did he get a pretty good singles match with Ray at WrestleMania, but he won. He won clean with the Crossroads at the end of the match. I'd give this 2.5 stars. Cody, you know, at the end, smashed Rey Mysterio's knee brace into Rey's face. It had been taken off a few minutes earlier. Rey did a dive, a suicide dive, through the ropes out of the ring, and as he flew out, he got whacked in the face with the knee brace, thrown inside Crossroads 1-2-3. So big win for Cody Rhodes, maybe the biggest of his entire career up to this point. I like Cody. There's something, he's got a certain charisma about him. I'm not big on this whole, you know, Phantom of the Opera type gimmick that he's got going on right now, where he's hiding his face, you know, thinking he's hideously disfigured when in reality he's not. But it's something for him. It's better than the dashing gimmick, I suppose. So this was fine. Nothing overly special. I thought Mysterio's Captain America costume was kind of cool. The one thing which some people pointed out to me, and I didn't even realize this when the match was initially over, that for weeks leading up to this match on SmackDown, Cody was promising to take Rey Mysterio's mask off after he beat him at WrestleMania. And I don't remember there being any mention of this at all on the pay-per-view, nor did Cody even attempt after the match was over to rip the mask off of Mysterio. So they just seemingly dropped the whole thing and forgot about it. So that was kind of stupid. We had Randy Orton one-on-one with CM Punk. Again, this was probably one of the better matches on the show, which isn't saying much, but I thought they had a 3-star match. I wouldn't go much higher than that. It was fine. It was like any match that you would see involving these two or any two stars on Raw. There was nothing overly special about it. There were no titles on the line, which is fine. The new Nexus, of course, never made an appearance because they were punted to hell by Randy Orton in the weeks leading up to the show. I'm not even sure if there is a new Nexus anymore. We didn't see them on Raw Monday night either, and at this point I think it's better off for Punk if he just puts together a new group, or I just, you know, if they would bring Colt Cabana into that company and just put him with Punk as a lackey, that would be so much better. But Randy Orton goes over here clean with an RKO. I like what they did at the end when Orton went for the punt on Punk, collapsed in the middle of the ring. I guess he was playing possum, because as Punk sauntered over to Orton to pick him up, Randy sprung into action, went for an RKO, and under normal circumstances, that would be it right there, but Punk slithered out of it, and I thought that was really cool. And then he went for the springboard off the ropes and got caught in a midair RKO for the pin, 1-2-3, that's all she wrote. So Randy Orton's WrestleMania dominance, I guess WrestleMania 25 aside, continues over the last couple of years. And then we got Michael Cole with Jack Swagger against Jerry the King Lawler, with Stone Cold Steve Austin as the special guest referee. Now, first things first, Lawler came out to his old theme music, which I ranted about this on the last show on Raw, the go-home edition of Raw before the pay-per-view. For the first time in years and years, they decided to change Lawler's theme music, and it sucked. And thankfully, they realized it sucked too, because it was nowhere to be heard this week. WrestleMania, he came out to his usual royal theme music, so that was a thumbs up. And what an interesting match this was. This was the match that was easily the best promoted thing on the entire show. The Michael Cole character has just, this has been building and building and building for months, probably 6 months at this point or more. And for the most part, they've kept Lawler and Cole away from each other, which is not an easy thing to do when the two of them essentially sit within 5 or 10 feet of each other at ringside doing commentary on the same show every single Monday night. So Cole came out dressed up in this amateur wrestling outfit. He had the headgear and he had a singlet that was not all that complimentary, I guess, to his physique. He had a whole bunch of tattoos on his body. Even Chris Jericho made fun of him for it on Twitter. I don't know what the significance of the tattoos were. They didn't zoom in close enough for me to even see what it was, but just, I didn't expect Michael Cole to be tatted up like that. And Lawler came out wearing his old school robe that I used to wear in Memphis, and I think he wore it in the movie Man on the Moon too, which was about, you know, the whole Andy Kaufman. And then Steve Austin comes out on his ATV, almost ran over Jack Swagger. That was kind of cool. The thing about this match that I thought was absolutely hilarious, and I think I said this in the live coverage I was doing on the site, by the time this match was over, this entire segment was over, I lost count on how many times Steve Austin said the word fuck. I mean, it was comical. Every other word out of Austin's mouth was the F word. Which should not be surprising, considering that it's Steve Austin. But, I mean, the camera would be on him, and he would be mouthing these words. And I seriously, every other word out of his mouth was fuck. Fuck this, fuck that, fuck you, fuck your mother. They're going to have to do some heavy editing on this match, methinks, when they put this on DVD. So I thought that was funny. What was not funny was the amount of offense that Michael Cole got in on Jerry Lawler. Now, you had a ton of stalling at the beginning of this match. And then finally, Lawler climbs into the coal mine where Cole was hiding, starts beating him up. There was this great visual of Cole's face getting pressed up against the plexiglass, which I thought was funny. And Jack Swagger attacked Lawler from behind on the outside, which gave Michael Cole an opportunity to go on the offense. That was his opening. And the problem is, and I timed these matches with my iPhone, actually, so I could give some times with them. Well, one of the things I should have done was time the number of minutes that Cole was just kicking Jerry Lawler's ass. And, you know, Lawler had to sell for this just way, 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 way too long. To the point where the crowd started chanting boring. And this really pissed me off because this was the easiest match in the world to book. I mean, just the easiest match in the world to book. You know, if you give Cole any offense at all, you give him about, you know, a minute or two of offense, and then Lawler comes back and starts just beating the shit out of Michael Cole. And I know this, you know, the no blood policy and everything, although this would have been a great opportunity for Michael Cole to do his first blade job. But you know what? Blood or no blood, the guy should have gotten his ass kicked. They should have allowed Lawler at the end to give him three straight pile drivers. Keep Cole off TV for a week or two. Have him come back to the announce booth wearing a neck brace or a halo around his head, threatening that he's going to file a lawsuit against Jerry Lawler. You know, if you're going to continue this angle, that would have been a perfectly acceptable, believable, funny way to keep it going. But instead they had, I mean, Cole was just beating him up, and then Lawler came back. The crowd didn't care about it at all. Of course, Swagger got into the ring, ate a stunner from Austin. You knew that was going to happen. And the way this ended was with a Lawler fist drop off the top rope. You know, and or there was a tease near fall, and then he put Cole in the ankle lock. And I thought it was kind of funny that Austin kept asking him, "Do you submit?" And Cole was just furiously tapping on the mat. And Austin was like, "Do you submit?" Finally, he called for the bell, and that was it. Jerry Lawler got his first match, his first win at WrestleMania, celebrated in the ring with Steve Austin. Of course, Lawler doesn't drink. I think Lawler has said before that he's never once in his life, he claims, has he even tasted a sip of alcohol. And when Steve Austin gave him the two beer cans and he went up to the top, I guess it happened off camera when the camera panned back onto Austin and away from Lawler. Apparently Lawler spilled some of it out and just threw them on the ground. So I thought that was kind of funny. Booker T, who had come out before this match to do commentary with Jim Ross. How could I forget? Jim Ross did, in fact, do announcing on this show. They came out to join Josh Matthews. Booker T got up from the announce booth, went into the ring to celebrate out of nowhere. I don't know why he felt that he had the right to get involved here, but he was very excited, apparently. He gave Jerry Lawler a big hug and was drinking some beer with his fellow Tough Enough trainer, Steve Austin. Then Booker T, after doing a spin-a-rooney, took a stone-cold stunner, took a great bump off that stunner, too. Very Rock-esque in the way he took that move. Then, of course, the anonymous Raw GM dings in, and Josh Matthews reads the announcement that the referee in this match overstepped his boundaries, and therefore he was reversing the decision and awarding the victory as a result of a disqualification to Michael Cole. So Lawler, it will go down in the record books, wherever these record books are, that Michael Cole beat Jerry Lawler at WrestleMania. Lawler gets outside the ring. He grabs Josh Matthews, who, of course, is an innocent bystander. He did nothing wrong here. This is a total heel move. Throws Matthews in the ring, and then Austin gives Josh Matthews a stunner. It even seemed like some of the fans who popped for the stunner anyway, but even the people in the crowd were like, what the fuck? It's not the kid's fault. So, whatever. You can argue that the ending to this with the whole reversal was a good thing or not, but the thing that killed this match, and I won't say that this was worse as a match than Bret Hart versus Vince McMahon was last year. I see a lot of comparisons being made to that match. And you can make those comparisons in that, you know, at WrestleMania last year, when Bret Hart went on the offense against Vince McMahon with that steel chair, he literally beat the shit. Well, I shouldn't say literally. That obviously, he didn't literally beat the shit, but he beat the shit out of Vince McMahon with about 15 straight chair shots, or I think it was 13 or something. And Bret can only do so much, God bless him, but it went on forever, and it killed the entire match. I mean, that's a match that was 12 years in the making, and should be the easiest thing in the world to book, and they fucked that up, and they did the same thing here. Apparently, Dean Malenko was the agent who was in charge of laying this match out, and he's come under some fire, because people are very unhappy inside the company with the way this match turned out. And I don't know that you can lay the full blame on Dean Malenko. Again, at the end of the day, Vince McMahon is the end-all be-all of what you see on TV, but this match, let's just say that this match would have been booked a little bit differently if I had some control over it. I think a lot of us would have booked it the same way. It's, like I said, the easiest thing in the world to do, and somehow they managed to fuck it up, and that's a shame. I give this 1 star, by the way, if I have to give it a star rating. And Cole, by the way, now is referring to himself as Mr. WrestleMania, since he's officially 1-0, and Shawn Michaels, of course, is retired. But, I was thinking about this. When I think of Mr. WrestleMania, that whole moniker, you know, people have been calling Shawn Michaels Mr. WrestleMania now for years. But when I think of Mr. WrestleMania, really, I think of 5 guys. I think of Shawn Michaels, obviously. I think of The Undertaker. I mean, you know, Shawn Michaels, there's no explanation needed. I mean, there is not a single performer in the history of that company that has had more amazing matches on the WrestleMania stage consistently, year after year, than Shawn Michaels. I mean, WrestleMania 10 is probably the first big show you could point to where he truly stole the show with that ladder match. The Iron Man match at WrestleMania 12, some people absolutely hate that match. I have seen that match in more recent years. I've gone back to watch it. It is a pretty boring match until you get later on into it. But still, for those two guys to go out there for 60 minutes and do what they did, people look back on that match very fondly. And Shawn Michaels was a big part of that. And really, it was the second part of his career when he was able to consistently put on the best match at WrestleMania every year against people like Jericho, Kurt Angle, John Cena, Ric Flair, The Undertaker. So there is no explanation needed where Shawn Michaels is concerned. Where The Undertaker is concerned, I would say The Undertaker is barking up HBK's tree. You know, The Undertaker, obviously, it's a gimmick, but he's got the 19-0 WrestleMania streak that will never be broken. It's become a big thing. The thing about The Undertaker that absolutely blows me away, just amazes me when I think about this. I mean, this is the same guy that made his very first WrestleMania appearance in a very brief, nothing throwaway match with Jimmy Snuka at WrestleMania 7, 1991. And, I mean, the matches he had at the beginning of his WrestleMania run were just awful. I personally liked the Jake the Snake match, but as a match, it really wasn't all that great. Giant Gonzalez, there's only so much a poor guy can do. WrestleMania 11, King Kong Bundy, Psycho Sid 2 years later. So Undertaker had a lot of shitty opponents. And the thing about Undertaker is, he's always been a big guy. He's a legit 6'9", 6'10". I first started reading, you know, rumors and news on the internet. I used to subscribe to a newsletter. One of the first newsletters I subscribed to was an online one that got emailed every, it might have actually been a couple of times weekly, by Peter Scaretta, who was the Slammer. It was the, I think it was the Mat Rap, or whatever it was called. And this goes back to like 1995, 1996. And even then, I was hearing stories about how beat up The Undertaker was and how he may only have another 2 or 3 years left in his career and his knees were bothering him. And then in the late 90s, I started hearing about how he's going to have a double hip operation. And, you know, he was in that six-pack challenge match at one of the pay-per-views in late 99. And then like 2 weeks before the show, The Undertaker, when he was the Ministry Undertaker, just on TV, just took himself out of the match. And they had to replace him with the British Bulldog. And in reality, it was because The Undertaker needed to have surgery. He was very beat up. He needed time off. And this was 10, 12 years ago. And The Undertaker has only gotten better in the ring with age. Now, I think he's finally reached a point in the last, really in the last year, where his body is just failing on him. And I think we are truly, finally, on the tail end of whatever career Undertaker has left as an in-ring performer. But here's a big guy that nobody ever looked at as being any sort of great in-ring performer in the early days, who in the last 5 years or so has absolutely stolen the show with whoever his opponent was year after year. I mean, you could say, well, that's what happens when you're in the ring with a guy like Shawn Michaels or Triple H, two of the best of all time, but you know, he went out there and arguably stole the show with Batista at WrestleMania 23, and Batista will never go down as being one of the greatest in-ring performers of all time. I thought he had a very good match with a young Randy Orton in 2005. So I think of Undertaker as well. I think of Bret Hart when I think of Mr. WrestleMania. Bret Hart had a lot of great WrestleMania matches. He was, you know, every single WrestleMania from WrestleMania 2 to WrestleMania 13. And it's kind of interesting to look back on that because, you know, even as a tag team performer in the mid-80s, you know, at WrestleMania 2, his very first Mania show, Bret was the last person eliminated in the big battle royal by Andre the Giant. He went to the very end. You know, 2 years later, he was in another battle royal at WrestleMania and was the very last person to be eliminated. He was dumped out by Bad News Brown. He went on to have great matches with Roddy Piper, with Owen Hart, with Shawn Michaels, with Steve Austin, of course. I think Mr. WrestleMania, I think Bret Hart. Hulk Hogan, obviously, doesn't really need much of an explanation. Not the same sort of in-ring performer that Bret Hart was or Shawn Michaels was, but without Hulk Hogan, there is no WrestleMania. I am not sitting here talking about WrestleMania right now if it were not for Hulk Hogan. You know, every single one of those WrestleManias from the very first one up until number 9, and even when the guy came back at 18 and stole the show with The Rock at the Sky Dome. When I think of WrestleMania, the first name that pops into my head is Hulk Hogan, because without one, you cannot have the other. And last but not least, I know I'm off on a rant here, but the fifth guy I think about when I think of Mr. WrestleMania is Randy Savage, who I don't think gets enough credit for putting on a lot of great WrestleMania performances. A lot of my fond memories from those early WrestleManias were from Randy Savage, from the match with Steamboat, from wrestling four times in one night and winning the title in the tournament, the match with Hogan, that whole storyline, carrying the Ultimate Warrior, arguably probably the best match of Warrior's career. That post-match stuff with Elizabeth that year was just fantastic stuff. The match with Ric Flair. So anyway, I just had to mention this because I hear Cole now calling himself Mr. WrestleMania, and I gave that some thought, and I said, who do I really think of when I hear that? I think of Hogan, I think of Michaels, but it's those five guys that I think of. All of them deserve credit for being Mr. WrestleMania at some point in their career. So anyway, back to this year. We had the core taking on Santino Marella, Vladimir Kozlov, Kane, and The Big Show. Of course, Kozlov was taken out by the core in an angle that they shot during a match at one of the fan access sessions, which I thought was rather cool. And then, of course, they followed up on that by not even showing any footage on the pay-per-view of what happened, so way to go. So he was replaced by Kofi Kingston, but it really didn't matter because this match went about 90 seconds, and then The Big Show punched Heath Slater in the face, pinned him, and that was the end of it. So I'm not even going to give this match a rating because it was a freaking waste of time, so why bother? And then we got Undertaker and Triple H. No holds barred. Again, it is amazing to look at The Undertaker's career and a guy who all he used to do was choke people and give them a tombstone, and to think that he has put on the types of performances that he has done is a credit to The Undertaker himself. I mean, I don't know what else to say. We know he was banged up coming in. We know his shoulder is fucked. His body is breaking down. He looks older, just facially. He looks a lot older in the last year than he has in the last couple of years. And give credit to Triple H. Both of these guys, they came out and did what I don't think too many people thought they could do. Which was not just put on a good match, but put on the type of show-stealing match that they were able to have. and convince people, not everybody, but I think they convinced a lot of people in the building last Sunday that the Undertaker's streak was not only in jeopardy, but there was one particular near fall in this match that, God bless them, they had the people in that building, based on the reaction that I saw and heard, thinking that the streak was over. And I think you know what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the tombstone spot. We did not get any Shawn Michaels involvement like I had predicted, which really surprised me. And I, again, the tombstone spot did a fine job of getting people to believe the streak might end. I still think a well-placed super kick to The Undertaker before bailing and then allowing Triple H to slow crawl onto Taker for the near fall would have been even more believable. But this was still great stuff. Jim Ross, by the way, after Josh Matthews was stunnered earlier on, Lawler came back to the commentary booth, and we had JR and the King reunited with no third voice, just the two of them doing commentary, and it was actually really nice. Jim Ross made this match so much better than Michael Cole ever could have, just for his call alone after that tombstone spot where Triple H gave Undertaker the tombstone, and Undertaker kicked out, and you know, Ross just goes, "What have we just seen? What have we just seen?" And Triple H looked like he had seen a ghost. It was just great, great drama. And I will say this to all the people, and there are very few of these people, but there are people nonetheless who completely crapped all over this match because they thought it was just a bunch of spots and they were just kicking out of each other's finishers, which, by the way, is what Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker pretty much did, you know, for not all of their match, but a lot of their match 2 years ago. And they did some of that last year, too. And, you know, you'll never be able to convince me that those matches were anything other than excellent. And again, it's all subjective, but you really do have to be operating on a different brain wavelength to think that, for example, the Michaels-Undertaker matches, if you are a wrestling fan, were not, at the very least, very good exhibitions. But for people to just crap all over it, "Oh, this match did nothing for me, it was garbage." You know what? If you can't get excited watching a match like this, then I don't know why you bother watching wrestling in the first place. You may as well just stop listening to this right now. Don't put Raw on Monday night. Don't bother watching Impact. Don't bother watching wrestling. Find another hobby. Find another sport. Find a girlfriend. Find something. Because if you cannot get into this after watching this match, if you can't feel anything besides anger and hate and indifference watching this match or total apathy, then I don't know what to tell you, because this is as good as it's going to get. And you just wonder how many more matches like this do we have left? How many more matches does The Undertaker have left? How many more matches does Triple H have left? Michaels is already gone. And if John Cena's match with The Miz in the main event of this very show is any indication, we are not in good hands in the future. And I'm going to get to Cena in a second. One of the things about this match, and by the way, before I get to this, let me just say that they went right at one another outside the ring when the match started. There was no, you know, collar and elbow tie-up or anything like that. Undertaker threw Triple H out of the ring, and they went right to their table spots. And again, it was a no-holds-barred match. And we know that there are certain limitations to what, for example, Undertaker could do. So I was fine with it. I had no problem with that whatsoever. Triple H took a back body drop bump off of the announce table, which looked like it sucked. Looked like he hurt his wrist. He was just selling, thankfully. That was a big bump. I mean, Undertaker is a legit, let's say, 6'9". And that table, I would say the table itself is probably, I don't know, let's just say 3 feet off the ground. So you got Triple H getting backdrop almost 10 feet in the air, crashing down onto those, you know, the padding, which can be very unforgiving. And then Undertaker doing his suicide dive. Now, I did not think that we were going to see this dive. I don't remember Undertaker doing it last year. I thought that this poor son of a bitch learned his lesson 2 years ago when he almost died. And he was supposed to be caught, and he wasn't caught, and he landed on his head, and I thought he broke his neck. I don't remember him doing the dive last year. I could be wrong about that. So I just assumed, good. He's hurt. There's no way he's going to do it. And what does he do? He dives over the top rope out of the ring. Triple H, again, barely catches him. At first, it looked like he landed on his head. I guess he landed on his shoulder, which is probably even worse for him than landing on his neck. But to his credit, he was up on his feet about, you know, 30 seconds later. He was up on his feet before Triple H was. And then there was a great spine buster spot through the table and just a lot of great stuff in this match. And the facials and the one thing if I had to criticize was Undertaker selling. He looks like a drunken fool sometimes, and it goes on for way too long. But I could totally buy into the fact that this guy is in agony. And it's almost uncomfortable at times to watch, you know, what he puts himself through. But that's a minor criticism. I mean, that's nitpicking at its finest right there. The one thing here was there was a chair shot. There were actually several chair shots in this match, mostly to The Undertaker and Triple H's backs. But there was one particular chair shot where Triple H clobbered Undertaker in the head with a chair. Now, Undertaker got his hand up. People say he didn't. He did. Go back and watch it. Because on one of the, I think the last replay, they showed like three or four replays after the chair shot, which surprised me that they would even replay that, seeing as it's against WWE policy now to deliver a chair shot to the skull. But it was plain as day on that last replay they showed that at the very last second, the pro that he is, Undertaker got his hand up. So it was not, in fact, an unprotected chair shot to the head, but it looked that way. And after the show, actually, I think a couple of days after the show, on the WWE corporate website, they posted the following. They said, pursuant to WWE's concussion policy, the stunt of using a folded metal chair to the head is prohibited. Triple H and The Undertaker have both been fined for violating this policy at WrestleMania 27. WWE penalizes through fine and or suspension for violation of this policy, which is unchanged and still in effect. I think they did that more than anything else to cover their ass. They wanted to let people know, hey, we know that we have this policy in place. We have not abandoned it. These are two very big stars, but they are not immune to the policy, and therefore we wanted you all to know that they have been punished accordingly. Now, they did not announce what the fine was, so I don't know if it was 50 cents. I don't know if it was $5,000. They didn't say. I'm almost positive they were fined. I don't buy into the fact that it was any sort of hefty fine. I'm not saying it was a dollar, but people seem quick to conclude that it's all bullshit. I don't think it is bullshit, because if anybody was to press on this, which of course no legislative body is going to bother with this, but I'm sure there was a fine levied against both men. They paid it. It was an insignificant amount compared to perhaps what it could have been, and they're just doing it to cover their ass. But I do think that they were both fined. And you know what? Again, I don't have a problem with it, because I know The Undertaker got his hand up, and if done safely, there is a correct way to do these things. And if you are going out of your way to protect yourself, I don't have a problem with it. It's the idiots who just, you know, with blind, reckless abandon, you know, whack people in the head with a chair and stuff like that. And there was a bump later in the show, an unintentional bump in the main event where somebody's skull got cracked in a different way. And it was just sickening. It was an accident, but when I saw it, you know, my stomach turned. And, people pay attention to these sorts of things now. They pay attention to concussions and stuff like that. It's serious shit. You know, we have tons of stories and studies that come out on a regular basis about NFL players and the effects that it has on their brains. And, you know, times are changing, and we know more now than we used to. And I have no problem. I think it's a great policy that WWE has, but, knowing that The Undertaker got his hand up, it changes everything, because there's a correct way to do these things. Look, a well-placed chair shot to the head, if you do it the right way, can have a very big impact, no pun intended. And that was a big spot in the match. You know, it's been a while since we've seen somebody going around whacking people in the head with a chair. The less that you do of something, the more impact it has. Kind of like blood, you know, the use of blood in matches and stuff like that. So I just thought that was kind of funny. Funny in that the two guys on the roster who you would think would know better, especially since one of them is probably going to be running the company at some point, and in some ways already is the one who actually made this transgression on the biggest show of the year. So this was just great stuff. I don't know what else there is to say. 4.5 stars I give this match. It was up there with the very first Michaels Undertaker match. I still think that match was better. But I like this match, I think, better than the Undertaker Michaels match from last year, where Shawn retired. I just really, really like this. And if you are a wrestling fan, you can argue that it wasn't a perfect match. You can argue that, well, they went too long, or they sold for too long, or, you know, I was hoping to see this and we got that. But for people to just turn around and say, this match sucked, you know, this match was awful, it was terrible, it's overrated, it's this and it's that, I don't know what the hell you're smoking, because this was a fantastic match. And there's nothing that could be said that could change my mind. Because I've watched the match two more times to make sure that I wasn't just, you know, sometimes you watch these things the first time and when you go back and watch it again, you realize, okay, maybe it wasn't as great as I thought. But nope, that match was still as great as I thought, so I'm sticking to the 4.5 stars. John Morrison, Trish Stratus, and Snooki against Dolph Ziggler and Lay Cool. I gave this a 1.5 stars just because I was impressed by Snooki. You know, she's a former cheerleader, I guess, in high school, and she's got some athletic ability in her little body, and she did that handspring back elbow in the corner on Michelle McCool, and she did another handspring cartwheel type thing into a pretty poor-looking splash to get the pinfall, but you know, what little athleticism she showed when she was in there impressed me. So, like I said, 1.5 stars. Now, there's been some stories during the week about Trish Stratus and John Morrison, and I didn't believe any of it at first. It just sounded a little, too over the top for me. And basically, these stories were that, you know, certain people in the company, in terms of performers like a John Morrison and Melina, who of course are an item, were very upset that Trish Stratus and Snooki were given spots in this match over some of the other divas, perhaps like a Melina or Maryse or Kelly Kelly. I know for a fact that Kelly Kelly was originally supposed to be in this match with Trish and John Morrison, so Snooki essentially was given the Kelly Kelly spot. But apparently, you know, there was some heat where John Morrison was giving Trish Stratus supposedly the cold shoulder, and I don't know what that was all about. And like I said, I didn't believe much of it. And then Trish Stratus went on the radio. She was on the Dave LaGreca show on Sirius Satellite Radio, and she was asked about John Morrison, and she very politely buried him, essentially. She said he was a very talented performer. She questioned his decision-making, which was, I think, an interesting choice of words. She noted that he wasn't interested at all before the match in discussing spots with her. And then afterwards, when she went to hug him, he kind of blew her off and gave her the cold shoulder, which makes me question his sexuality, because any hot-blooded heterosexual male giving Trish Stratus the cold shoulder and blowing her off has some issues, in my opinion. I'm just saying. So that came straight from Trish's mouth, so apparently there were some issues there. And apparently several of the women in the company just were not happy. They were supposed to be, there was supposed to be a Divas match aside from this one, and essentially it got cut due to time constraints, and because, in part because of this match, which in and of itself, this match was about 2 or 3 minutes long. A lot of the matches on the show were shortchanged for one reason or another. Triple H and The Undertaker, I think, was the only match that got any real length of time. They went just shy of 30 minutes, according to my iPhone timer. And no match came close. I mean, the main event, even with the restart, went maybe 15 minutes. It's just, unfortunately, there weren't a lot of matches that went very long on this show. The thing about this is, I don't really get why you would be upset with Trish Stratus, or why you would even be upset with Snooki. WWE went to Snooki, or they went to Snooki's people, and they said, we want you on the show. You know, they were impressed by the job she did, you know, on the Raw, where she was the guest star, although even before that, they already had a deal worked out with her, where she would be on the WrestleMania show. They know that Jersey Shore is a pop culture phenomenon. They really honestly thought that perhaps they'd get some buys for it, but they were interested in the media publicity, and they had a lot of media cover the show. You know, that handspring cartwheel back elbow bullshit that Snooki busted out at the pay-per-view was on a couple of different TV shows, and it was talked about on a lot of the entertainment blogs. It just makes WWE seem fun and important and special. And, you know, it was relatively unoffensive just because it was so short. You know, it wasn't dragged out like the Michael Cole match. It wasn't like they gave Snooki 8 minutes of offense on Lay Cool. So I don't understand why you would be upset with them. Why wouldn't you be upset with Vince McMahon or Kevin Dunn or the people responsible for inviting her in the first place? It wasn't like Snooki put a gun to their head and said, well, I'll show up at your pay-per-view, but only if you put me in a match. It wasn't her idea. It was their idea. So it's this misplaced sense of anger, I think. But, you know, for John Morrison to give the cold shoulder or to basically behave like a little bitch is what it sounds like to me, will not do him any favors. In fact, being with Melina will not do him any favors, and it has come back to bite him on the ass before, and I'm sure it will come back to bite him on the ass again. But that's a different story for a different day. So I don't understand any of this at all. This seems like juvenile high school bullshit. It's not, again, I wouldn't even blame, it's not their fault. It's not Trish's fault. It's not Snooki's fault. Yeah, it's your own fault. Maybe if Melina was a bigger star and actually had something going right now, some sort of program or something, maybe she would have had a spot on the WrestleMania card. But Melina has said things and done things in the past. She's rubbed people the wrong way. That's why she's in the position she's in right now. She doesn't get a lot of TV time. There's a reason for that. And I understand that John Morrison's her boyfriend. And if you're the boyfriend, you've got to stick up for the girlfriend. And I get that. I get that whole thing. But John Morrison is on the cusp of something here. If he can get his shit together, and again, if he can get better on promos, because I think he sucks as a promo guy, personally. If you give him a mic without a script, maybe he won't be so bad, but that's not going to happen. So you've got to learn to take the material that WWE gives you, no matter how shitty it might be, and do the exact opposite of what John Cena does, and actually deliver it in a believable way that people will not turn against you. And he's just not that good at it, in my opinion. That's what he needs to focus on. He's on the cusp of something big. I could see him as a future world champion. At the same time, I could see stupid shit like this politically working against him backstage. So I guess we'll see where Morrison ends up in the weeks to come. I don't know if he's going to keep something going with Dolph and Vicky, or if they're going to put him in a different program. I don't know. That wasn't made entirely clear on Raw this past Monday. So then we have the main event. We have John Cena challenging The Miz for the WWE Championship. And this was the match that Vince McMahon ultimately decided that the show should end with this match. It would not, in fact, end as originally planned with Triple H and The Undertaker. And yes, Triple H and The Undertaker ended up having a great match. And I think if you would have ended the show with that match, I don't think too many people would have complained. But at the end of the Undertaker-Triple H match, Undertaker looked like he was dead. And by the way, for the people who have asked, I'm sure he was very beat up, but he was selling. They put him on this cart, and they basically drove him out of the arena. He didn't leave on his own power, as he usually does. And it was all selling on his part. Very good, very believable selling, because like I said, he looked like he was just fucking completely dead. I don't know that that's the way you should end WrestleMania. So, you know, hindsight being what it is, you could go either way on this. But they decided, okay, Cena versus Miz is going to end, and whatever we're going to do with The Rock, that's what the people came to see, that's what we're going to end the show with. And that's fine. The problem is what they had planned for The Rock was underwhelming. You know, The Rock he was on the receiving end of an attitude adjustment the last time we saw him on TV. And in interviews, he continued to threaten John Cena on Twitter and such. He said he was going to kick his ass. He did this great interview with a group of international reporters at one of the Access sessions that weekend. And I posted the clip on Facebook. If you go to facebook.com/TheSolomonster, I posted the link up there. And it was a very brief, it was a 12-minute video. But it's this one particular point about 2 minutes in where somebody starts to ask him a question about, and they mention John Cena's name. Cena's name comes up for the first time, and The Rock is looking off camera at whoever the guy is, and The Rock just responds, and he says, "I'm going to fuck him up." That's basically what The Rock said, in those exact words. He's going to fuck John Cena up. And I laughed my ass off at that clip. And it got me even more excited, because I figured we're going to see a colossal ass-whipping at WrestleMania. And what we got at WrestleMania was not an ass-whipping. It was a little less than an ass-whipping. And I think that goes to the heart of why people, I think, were disappointed. They were expecting more. The way they handled this whole thing sucked. As a WrestleMania main event, it was one of the worst WrestleMania main events of all time. I will say that right now. As a match, it was one of the worst WrestleMania main events of all time. I won't say that it was worse, for example, than Lawrence Taylor and Bam Bam Bigelow. There have been some, you know, Undertaker and Sid. I was not all that fond of that match, although that may well have been better than this. John Cena, well, I guess let's back up a little bit here. First of all, they put this promo package together for The Miz, set to the song Hate Me Now. It was great. Find the video on YouTube or buy the WrestleMania DVD. This video was phenomenal. It was great. And the stuff with John Cena, they had this choir singing a song, and then they segued into a video package for Cena. And then they came back, and the choir was still singing. And then Cena finally came out. This was a fucking waste of time, and people were actually booing the choir. They were booing Cena, but they were booing the choir to boo Cena. So if the idea was, well, we're going to do this whole thing with a church choir, and we're going to, you know, we're going to bring this religious aspect to it, and these people certainly can't boo John Cena for that. No, they can pretty much boo John Cena for any reason at all, because they gave him a heel reaction that anybody would have expected that he was going to get. The entrance didn't do anything to change that. All the entrance did was waste time. This was a waste of 10 minutes of time. So he finally comes out, the match starts, and there was a one point like 3 minutes into the match where Cena is punching John Cena, or rather Miz is punching John Cena, and Miz shouts at Cena, "Stay down." And I thought to myself, really? We just saw this in the Undertaker-Triple H match earlier. That was a war between two veterans, and the Undertaker kept kicking out and kicking out and kicking out, and Triple H is yelling at him, "Stay down, stay down," and it's totally believable. And you're 3 minutes into your WWE Championship match, you're punching John Cena in the head, and you're yelling at him, "Stay down, stay down." That was fucking stupid. That was a total ripoff of earlier, and it didn't fit, it didn't work, it was stupid. So they wrestle, and they wrestle, and they wrestle. Cena sucks, by the way. I mean, this was not a good match. I mean, this was not a good, and I'm not going to lay this at the feet of The Miz, either. I don't think it was so much his fault. I don't think Miz is a great wrestler anyway, but, you know, Cena just was not good. This was not a good match. I was bored by this match. And, of course, the people in the crowd were just waiting. They knew The Rock was going to come out at some point. So the action, I don't know, 12, 14 minutes in, whatever it was, spills out to the floor. And they did this thing where Cena threw Miz over part of the barricade, but not into the crowd. Like part of the barricade where the timekeeper and the ring announcer sit. And then Miz climbs on top of the barricade. I guess he's going into the crowd to run away from Cena. But instead of just going over, he's sitting on top of the barricade and turns around. And as he turns around, Cena comes charging at him. And both guys tumble over the barricade. And they fall into the crowd. And as they fall, the back of Miz's head smacks against the concrete floor. And at first I'm looking at this and I'm thinking, that looks like padding. It looks like hard padding that you would see like in a park or something. But I don't think it was padding. It looked like, upon further inspection, it was just the concrete floor. And, you know, Miz landed wrong, and he smacked his head on the concrete. And it was a sickening thud. You can hear it. You can hear his head splat on the mat. And he legitimately sustained a concussion, which is dangerous. I mean, that's a dangerous thing. Chris Nowinski suffered concussions like that, and he wasn't able to wrestle ever again. I don't want to see stuff like that happening to The Miz or anybody on the roster. It was, you know, it was a fluky thing. It wasn't planned or anything, but if you looked at The Miz's face from that point on, he was out of it. I mean, he looked like a guy that wasn't all there, and they got counted out. Now, I knew that this was not the way the pay-per-view was going to end, but still, you have a WrestleMania main event end on a double countout. So then The Rock comes out, and he apparently felt the same way that I did, because as he came out, the camera was on him, and you can clearly hear him mouth the words, "Fuck that shit," as he came down to the ring, grabbed the mic, cut another promo, so the second Rock promo now that we've gotten inside the ring tonight, not counting the two earlier backstage segments, which you'll notice I didn't even touch upon, because it's just not worth talking about. And Rock restarts the match, no count out, no disqualification, no time limit, and almost immediately, Cena grabs Miz, throws him into the ring. He looked like he was in a rush, and I think, I just wonder if Miz getting hurt and not being all there, if they were supposed to go a couple of minutes, instead of the 30 seconds that they ended up going. But they knew Miz was hurt. So almost immediately, you know, Rock had already gotten out of the ring. Rock slides back into the ring. Cena has his back turned, turns around, eats a Rock Bottom, which the crowd popped huge for. And Rock leaves the ring. Miz crawls over on top of Cena, doesn't even have the energy to hook the leg. And just like that, 1, 2, 3, pins him clean. Now, again, earlier on when they got counted out, the ring announcer announced that, you know, the title cannot change hands on a count out, therefore still WWE champion The Miz, and they played his music, and there were actually a lot of cheers in the crowd for that. So now, you know, 2 minutes later, Miz gets the pin, and yet again they play his music, and for the second time tonight at the pay-per-view, he retains his WWE title. It's only the second time in WrestleMania history that a heel, although on this night you can argue he was a babyface, but a heel has ended WrestleMania retaining his title. The first time that ever happened was WrestleMania 16, when Triple H won the Fatal 4-Way match, ironically last defeating The Rock, after Vince McMahon screwed him over to retain the WWF title. So that's it. That's essentially how the pay-per-view ended. The Rock was on the outside. He stared a hole through The Miz, came into the ring. He had a back and forth, because Miz didn't fight back. It was basically just Rock kicking his ass, punching him, and gave him a spine buster. Delivered a people's elbow, which was a little underwhelming, again, because we saw him already deliver the people's elbow on Raw the previous week. And that was it. He did posing on the turnbuckles. They played his music. He, the guy that wasn't even in the main event is the last face that you see celebrating. The Miz is left laying, and The Rock is celebrating, and WrestleMania goes off the air. And I wouldn't have handled it that way. You know, I don't know that I would have had Cena win the title. It's not that I have a problem with that. I'm actually happy, quite frankly, that they kept the belt on The Miz. It was a ballsy move on their part. And at this point, I think I would just run with the guy. You know, I mean, hell, they gave JBL a year, almost a year-long reign with the title. I think you can give Miz some time with the championship as well before he drops it. There's no reason that Cena has to have the belt. Cena's one of these guys already who, he doesn't need the belt at all. I mean, obviously he'll win it back at some point, but he doesn't need the belt. So why not keep it on The Miz, make him look stronger, and build to somebody like a Morrison, maybe, or somebody of that ilk, eventually dethroning him and winning the championship. But the way they booked this whole thing with The Rock's interaction and everything, it felt like it was an angle that was just there to promote the next chapter and whatever it was that they were doing. It was almost like it was very TNA-like in some respects, in that TNA is notorious for screwing the fans over on their pay-per-view shows. When they do this stupid shit, that clearly is a setup to impact the following Thursday. They will specifically do things on their pay-per-views, and they will even tell you on commentary, well, to find out what happens, or, you know, to find out what just happened here, you got to tune into Impact on Thursday. And it's like, you stupid motherfuckers, you made us pay for this pay-per-view to push your free show on TV. They do that shit all the time. And they did it, I think, on their most recent pay-per-view. They did it with RVD and Mr. Anderson. So this was not quite that egregious, but it was very similar to what TNA does. It was TNA-esque, and that's not a good thing. We knew that this wasn't going to be the end between Cena and The Rock. We knew Rock was going to be on Raw the next night, but there were other ways that you could have done this. Let's just say that Cena won the title. You could have had Cena win the title, and then Rock comes out, and you have a big pull-apart brawl between them. I mean, you send all your agents, all your officials, all your referees down there. It's not an official match, but these guys are going at each other like a real fight. Rock, 2 days before the pay-per-view, is saying, I'm going to fuck this guy up. Well, show us that you mean it. Go in there, and don't do your wrestling spots, and don't do your usual cute wrestling bullshit. Just go in there like a fight, and take it to the other guy, and then have the officials break him up in this big, pull-apart brawl. In fact, you could do the same outcome after having Miz retain the title. Cena should be upset. He should be angry. I just got screwed out of the title. And then he has the pull-apart with The Rock to end the pay-per-view. I mean, that's just one idea. That would have been, I think, a hot ending to the show that would have led to increased interest in Raw anyway. So, It's hard. You know, everyone has their own idea of how they could have handled it. I came away from this just feeling underwhelmed. And again, On a scale of 1 to 10, I think 6.5 is a good score for WrestleMania. It was not a great show. There was one great match on the show, but much like WrestleMania 2 years ago when I saw that first Shawn Undertaker match, one great match does not make for a great pay-per-view. Just remember that show. Triple H and Randy Orton ended that show, and that was a debacle all unto itself. And in some respects, this was very similar to what we had at the end of that show as well. Two very similar shows in that respect. By the way, I think I was 4-2 by my count in my WrestleMania predictions. I'm excusing the Sheamus. I picked Sheamus to go over Daniel Bryan. I'm not even counting that, since technically there was no singles match between them. And I don't think... actually, I'm 4-3, because I picked the core. Foolish as I may have been to pick the core actually going over in that match, I end up 4-3, which, you know what? It's a winning percentage, so I'll take it. Now, let's get to Kurt Angle here. Let's get to Kurt Angle. I love Kurt Angle. He's a great wrestler. He really is. Kurt is going to go down as one of the all-time great performers in the industry. But Kurt Angle is his own worst enemy. And when you have people like Kurt Angle, and you give them access to a service like Twitter in the year 2011, you're just asking for trouble. So, Kurt Angle was on a tweeting spree during and after the WrestleMania show. And here are just some of the tweets that came from Kurt's account that night after WrestleMania. He said, "To WWE wrestlers, don't use my finish." This is in reference to Randy Orton using his Angle Slam, which, by the way, Orton has been using the Angle Slam in his matches now for months. I first noticed that he ripped off the move from Kurt like months ago. So WrestleMania was not the first time he busted it out. He says, "Don't use my finish, get more creative." And he says, "I guess Swagger will use my ankle lock as well. Very creative. I'm the best in the world. You guys will never be Kurt Angle. Can I get an amen?" And he says, "Why would WWE use my finishes? Because I won't go back? Randy Orton, Angle Slam. Michael Cole, ankle lock. They have some nerve." And he says, "Jerry Lawler," and he spelled Lawler's name wrong, by the way. How could you spell Lawler wrong? Spells L-A-W-L-O-R. Says, "Jerry Lawler did it too, but he is a legend. WWE really stuck it to me. No love lost. I'm glad that I helped your biggest event of the year." So after all of this hilarity, he posts that, "Lastly, I just found out that somebody hacked into my Twitter account. Most of these tweets were not from me. I just found out today. I will find out who the person is." So then later on, it gets better, he claims that upon further investigation, his Twitter account was not hacked, in fact, but it was used by a family member after Kurt went to bed that Sunday night. I just love how Kurt posts all of these things, and almost immediately after those initial tweets, he says, after all of that, he basically turned around and said, "Oh, by the way, my Twitter was hacked, and everything you just read did not come from me." It's like, oh yeah, by the way. And then CM Punk, in one of the all-time great Twitter remarks. And if you're not on Twitter, by the way, and I can understand why you would want to stay away from it, there's, you either love Twitter or you hate Twitter. You know, for me, it's a way that, it's another, social media outlet for me to reach out to people who listen to the show and to promote the podcast. So that's why I do the Twitter and the Facebook thing. Some people like it, some people don't. But if for no other reason, you have to join Twitter to follow, not just me, but CM Punk. Because Punk is somebody who is notorious for expressing himself and speaking his mind. And Punk is following all of this because Punk and Orton, of course, hated rivals, are actually Twitter friends. And Punk sees all of this going on, and he simply posts, quote, "My Twitter account was hacked is the new I'm a sloppy drunk douche." I love it. How can you hate CM Punk? The guy is the ultimate babyface. The better part about all this, by the way, is that Randy Orton on Raw the very next night, and Orton knew this was going on. Orton actually, if I was Orton, quite frankly, I wouldn't have even wasted my time with this, but Orton actually responded on Twitter to Kurt Angle, and he was even asking the question, didn't Ken Shamrock first use the ankle lock, which is true, by the way. I always used to think that Kurt Angle stole the move from Ken Shamrock. I thought that would have made for a great match. But the best part about all this is that on Raw the very next night, Orton turned around and used the Angle Slam again. He used it on Cody Rhodes. I thought that was great. This, of course, all comes off the heels, or on the heels, I should say, of that whole incident where Kurt was he was already pulled over, I guess, in the middle of the road, and they smelled alcohol on his breath, and he pleaded guilty to the charges. He's not going to go to jail. I think he got a suspended jail sentence. He has to pay a fine. He's on some sort of unsupervised probation now, and Kurt Angle, like I said, can be his own worst enemy, but when I read those tweets, it was just like, Kurt, just shut the fuck up. You're not doing yourself any favors by spouting off at the mouth like this, and it's sad. You know, it's just sad that people, I just wonder if when I was younger and was really big into guys like Hogan and Savage and you know, even back in the mid-90s, when all that drama was going on with Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels, can you imagine if when all that shit was going on and Shawn Michaels was all pilled up on God knows what, if Twitter was around back then and Bret Hart was on Twitter and Shawn Michaels was on Twitter, can you just imagine? I mean, as a fan, it would have been fucking phenomenal, but, I mean, it would have been a complete disaster if something like this were invented back then when all that shit was going down. The company is a lot more buttoned up now, and they won't tolerate stuff like that, but back in the day, my God. But a guy like Kurt Angle, who uses his Twitter to promote his Angle Foods company, just stick to promoting your company, is what my advice to him would be, because he just made himself out to be a complete jackass this past week. And unfortunately, he was not the only one. And we'll get to that a little bit later on here in the show. Let's switch gears here, because there was another huge story this week. You might even say far bigger than WrestleMania, as it relates to WWE, and I'm talking about the new WWE. It is no longer World Wrestling Entertainment. World Wrestling Entertainment is no more. And this is official. They put a press release out a couple of days ago. At first, you know, this broke over WrestleMania weekend, and I was a little skeptical at first, but I pretty much, I could see that this was probably legit. We've heard for the longest time that Vince McMahon hates the word wrestling, and he's banned people from saying the word wrestling, and probably if he could, he would take it out of the name of his company, which is essentially what he's now done. This is essentially what has now happened. There was a meeting in Titan Towers about a week ago, and the decision was finalized by Vince McMahon that World Wrestling Entertainment, as you and I know, it no longer exists. The WWE initials will live on, but they will not have any meaning whatsoever. It's kind of like AOL. AOL used to stand for America Online. Maybe it still does, but for years now, they've been branded as AOL. Nobody says America Online anymore. It's AOL, and that's essentially what we are now seeing with WWE. It's basically a continuation of that policy where the words wrestler and wrestling are being phased out of their vocabulary. You know, the company had sent out its annual report this past week, and it listed its name as the new WWE. On its front page, it said that the launch of a WWE network is an example of one transformative change in our sights. You know, and they said that we believe the new WWE will ultimately generate meaningful earnings growth and support, blah, blah, blah. So, anyway, people are up in arms about this. They got their panties in a bunch. They shouldn't, because this is not something that should be all that surprising to anybody listening to this show. I'll talk in a second about how this impacted some of the Hall of Fame speeches last weekend. That actually made me more angry than anything else. But the other big part of this story here is not just the rebranding of the WWE name, but the announcement of their new talent developmental department, which is being headed up by Triple H, who was mentioned by his real name in the press release. And it's another sign that he is taking more of a corporate role in the company, being groomed at some point for the top spot. Apparently, Triple H is the one who, as the story goes, put the idea of a major push behind Sin Cara in place. In the announcement put out on the WWE corporate site, they mentioned Triple H heading up this new talent department. They credit the Sin Cara signing as the first big signing of he and his department. Now, I don't know that, you know, we can sit here and give Triple H the credit for him being in the company, because there's been a lot of interest for the last couple of years in bringing Mystico over. They almost did it in 2007. They actually brought Mystico into one of their tapings for a dark match before a SmackDown show. There was, you know, no audience. It was an empty arena. I think he worked a match. I want to say it was with Jamie Noble, if I remember correctly. And he blew everybody away. I mean, he had a lot of people in the company, including JBL at the time, Rey Mysterio, who vouched for him. They went to Stephanie McMahon. They said, sign this guy. And I think they tried to, but he had visa issues, and it just didn't work out. So I won't sit here and say, wow, all, you know, all hail Triple H for bringing Sin Cara over to the company. But it was apparently his idea to not just sign the guy, but do something different than you normally do, which is actually make a big deal out of it. You know, do this press conference in Mexico. That was the press conference they sent Jim Ross down south for. Make a big deal out of it and push him to the top of the card right away. I think it'll be interesting, because we will, over the course of time, begin to see exactly what sort of talent Triple H is interested in. Is he only interested? And Sin Cara is an exception to the rule, because he's one of these guys. He's like a Rey Mysterio in that he can do things in the ring that nobody else can do. But he's also a proven attraction down in Mexico, because for years, this guy was literally wrestling every single night, multiple times, every day of the week. He made millions of dollars. He was the lifeblood, in many respects, of the Mexican wrestling scene for many, many years, until the crowd started to turn against him in the last couple of years, very similar to the way they've turned against John Cena. They actually turned against Cena a long time ago, I guess. Is Triple H going to keep an open mind when signing more international talent in the future, or is it going to be a bunch of 6'5", 280-pound guys? I guess we'll have to take a wait-and-see approach on that, but that'll be one of the more interesting stories to follow over time, is what kind of people they bring into the company. All right, so that brings us to this past Monday. There was a lot of shit going on this past Monday, and I want to start out with Dancing with the Stars and Chris Jericho. And I'm not going to talk about him dancing so much. This leads into another story this week that I know many of you have heard about. First of all, on the show, I just have to mention this. I watched it. I watched his part, I should say, because I was flipping between that and the Hall of Fame. He did a song. He danced to the song Let It Be by the Beatles, which has a very emotional connection for him, because anybody who knows his history and read his new book knows how close he was with his mother. The accident that she had when she was paralyzed in a fight with her boyfriend. She took a, you know, she was, I think, she took a wrong spill. She became a paraplegic and confined to a wheelchair. She died a couple of years ago. And that song had a very personal connection for him. And he insisted that he be introduced on the show for that one night by his real name of Chris Irvin. And he did this dance with his partner, Cheryl Burke. I thought it was very good. You know, it wasn't, you know, the judges were a little more harsh, and Jericho didn't do as well this week as he did the previous week, but he made it past the next elimination round. He'll be back on the show this week, and good luck to him. I'd love to see him go all the way. But Jericho's name was in the news for a different reason, and in an interview with the Slam Wrestling website, superstar Billy Graham said that Jericho has, quote, the face of a choir boy, but the heart of a devil, and that one day someone will walk across his skull on the floor of hell. That's exactly where he belongs. That's what superstar Billy Graham had to say about Chris Jericho. Now, this is in response to comments that Jericho made in his new book, calling Graham a has-been, and that Graham was essentially all over the media in the aftermath of the Benoit murders. Just to get himself attention, which I could totally believe, by the way, knowing Billy Graham's history. Anybody who knows anything about superstar Billy Graham can easily believe that. And I don't believe Chris Jericho is the kind of person who would say that unless he honestly believed it. Those are the comments that Jericho made in his book. They are strong comments, but are they worthy of a response where the person tells you that you belong in hell and that he will walk across your skull on the floor of Hades? That might be a little bit of an exaggeration. Now, in the same interview, Graham said that he wants out of the WWE Hall of Fame. He was inducted in 2004. He wants out because of their induction of Abdullah the Butcher. He said that Abdullah never once competed in a WWE ring, which is true, and for him to be inducted is nothing short of, quote, blasphemy. He says, I am demanding that this company remove my name from their index of Hall of Fame wrestlers, which is funny because there is no physical Hall of Fame. I presume he means on their website. He says, it is a shameless organization to induct a bloodthirsty animal such as Abdullah the Butcher into their worthless and embarrassing Hall of Fame, and I want the name of superstar Billy Graham to be no part of it. The WWE and their Hall of Fame is disgustingly embarrassing. I want out. End quote. Like I said, he was inducted in 04, and apparently has since, in recent years, he sold his Hall of Fame ring on eBay. Here are my thoughts on Superstar Billy Graham. Superstar Billy Graham has fallen on some tough times health-wise. I mean, his health has been shit for many years, and he is very fortunate to be alive right now. He was in dire need, I believe it was of a liver transplant, and he told the story at his Hall of Fame induction in 04 about the young woman who, I guess, died in an accident. She was an organ donor. He was given her liver, and essentially that helped prolong his life. He would not be here right now if it wasn't for that girl's liver. He's had a lot of issues. He is an admitted steroid abuser to the point where in certain interviews, he's even taken credit for, you know, that steroid culture becoming as big as it was, because Graham was a big star in his heyday and a big star in the wrestling business, and he shot steroids up like there was no tomorrow. And his body paid the price for it, because in the 80s, his body started breaking down. By the late 80s, he was still a manager on TV. They brought him back, but he was on his last legs as far as a performer at that point. And it was in the late 80s, early 90s, when Billy Graham went on this vendetta against Vince McMahon and the World Wrestling Federation. And you can search on YouTube for the infamous Phil Donahue Show. It was an episode of Donahue, which was a big, hugely popular talk show in this country back in the day. And they were dealing with the whole issue of, there were a lot of sex allegations, sexual misconduct allegations levied against the World Wrestling Federation, steroid accusations. They had this one episode with a panel of people, including some of the accusers, and Vince McMahon himself was actually on stage. Dave Meltzer of the Wrestling Observer was sitting next to him. Superstar Billy Graham was there. Bruno Sammartino, another person who has had some ill will towards Vince McMahon in recent years, he was part of the panel. For reasons that were never quite explained to me, if you pay any attention watching the clip, Miss Elizabeth is actually in the audience by herself. I'm not sure why, but it's just fascinating to watch that. And the point that I'm making in mentioning this is that Billy Graham was one of the most outspoken vocal critics of Vince McMahon and the WWF around that time period. At some point, his viewpoint changed, and he became public enemy number one to the WWF, and he had a lot of horrible things to say, to the point where Pat Patterson, who was himself one of the people embroiled in these sex scandals and all of these accusations in the late 80s, early 90s, Pat Patterson had no love lost for Billy Graham, because he believed that Graham was lying his ass off, either for a payday or just because he had a bridge to burn and some sort of vendetta to settle with Vince McMahon. And it took a lot of years, but over time, Billy Graham basically admitted that he lied. He lied about much, if not all, of the bullshit. And he was inducted into the WWE Hall of Fame in 2004, and there was a segment, it was either in 04 or 05, when they did this segment. It was before SummerSlam, and it aired on one of those, like, Confidential or one of those WWE magazine-style shows at the time, showing, you know, Billy Graham backstage at one of the shows reuniting with Vince McMahon. They were embracing, and he apologized for the comments that he had made in the past. I don't know that Pat Patterson ever forgave him for that. But here's a guy who, you know, now that he's back in the good graces of the company, apologizes for all those incendiary remarks that he made. And it was serious shit, too, that he was saying about the company at the time. And believe me, Vince McMahon was no choir boy. I'm sure a lot of the shit that they were accused of was true. But here's this guy saying, oh, I'm sorry I lied about all that stuff and I made your life a living hell. You know, now that I'm back in your good graces and you are kind enough to put me in your Hall of Fame, which back in 2004 apparently meant the world the superstar Billy Graham. He had nothing but wonderful things to say about it. And in recent years, the company had actually put him on a stipend or whatever. I don't know if it was a Legends deal. And they'd done this with a lot of guys before, where he was getting paid, I'm not sure if it was $2,000 a week or per month. He was getting $2,000 essentially for nothing. He wasn't really doing anything for the company. And a couple of years ago, WWE decided that we're looking to cut costs, and one of the things we're going to do is we're not going to pay Billy Graham $2,000 a week or a month or whatever it is anymore to do nothing. It wasn't any sort of malicious move on their part. It was a cost-cutting measure, and they stopped paying him. And all of a sudden, when the money dried up and was no longer coming in, Billy Graham started talking shit once again about Vince McMahon and WWE. Isn't that funny the way that works? And then there was an incident in January, more recently. There was a Wrestle Reunion convention in L.A. I believe it was at Wrestle Reunion. And Billy Graham was there. You know, he wasn't sure if he was going to be able to show up because his health has been so poor. He didn't know if he could, you know, handle the trip, but he made it. And he was, you know, signing autographs and all of these different things. And anyway, there was a panel discussion later on during one of those days of the Wrestle Reunion event. And apparently, I don't know if Billy Graham was on the panel or if he just kind of sabotaged it. There was some sort of incident where he started going on a rant and a diatribe about something, and he was cursing, and he was using lots of foul language, and, you know, a lot of people were very upset because there were little kids in attendance there. Just made a complete jackass out of himself. So, the thing about Billy Graham is this. What we've established is that when Billy Graham is in the good graces of WWE, or is getting a paycheck from WWE, they're the best company in the world. And Vince McMahon is the best promoter and the best boss that anybody could ask for. And when he's not on WWE's payroll, or he's not in the good graces of the company for whatever reason, they are indeed, Vince McMahon is, the devil incarnate. They are a bunch of miscreants. Their Hall of Fame is a disgusting sham that he wants nothing to do with, and so on and so forth. So basically, Billy Graham is a delusional old bastard, is basically the message to take away from all this. I personally was never a fan of his. He was a little before my time anyway. I wasn't a fan of his when he was a champion. I wasn't a fan of his when he was a manager. I wasn't a fan of his when he was an announcer. I wasn't a fan of his in the mid-90s. I wasn't a fan of his when he went into the Hall of Fame. He didn't do anything for me. Yes, Jesse Ventura and Hulk Hogan essentially stole his shtick, and they can credit Billy Graham, who was definitely influential in the business. Make no mistake about it, he was a great promo guy. Not saying he wasn't good at that. But as a person, he's always come off to me as totally, totally two-faced. And this does absolutely nothing to change my opinion of him. I don't think he's a good person. I think he is no different than a lot of other guys who, again, when times are tough and shit happens, he kind of goes with however the wind blows. And he's not getting paid by WWE anymore. He's, you know, bothered for whatever reason by the fact that they would put Abdullah the Butcher in the Hall of Fame. Now, I saw the Don't Bleed on Me, the Canadian documentary on YouTube. I don't know that I'm going to have time to talk about it in this show. You could find it on YouTube and watch it, and maybe I'll talk about it next week. And Billy Graham is one of the wrestlers who is interviewed. And perhaps because of that, he just has this built-up animosity towards Abdullah the Butcher. What that has to do with, you know, WWE's Hall of Fame being a disgusting, you know, cesspool, or however he wants to phrase it, is a little over the top to me. And to make the comments about Jericho is a little over the top. It seems like a lot of these old wrestlers, who were never really any good, are coming out of the woodwork because they're bothered when people tell the truth about them. Larry Zbysko is another person. Chris Jericho had some unkind words in his book for the so-called living legend. So what does Larry Zbysko do? Well, he does the most mature thing that you could possibly imagine. He goes on YouTube and he records one or two videos where he basically bashes Chris Jericho. I think he challenged him to a fight. I didn't bother watching the whole thing. All I know is that he went on YouTube and he made a jackass out of himself. And again, Larry Zbysko, who had some measure of success in the wrestling industry, not a lot, but he had a little bit in the AWA, I think he was married to Vern Gagne's daughter or something. I'm sure that didn't have anything to do with it. He was an announcer in WCW. He was a shitty announcer at that, by the way. And he comes out of the woodwork because somebody had the audacity to make a comment, telling it like it is, that Larry Zbyszko really wasn't any good. So, superstar Billy Graham, the living legend Larry Zbyszko, living legend, by the way, in his own mind, should all just keep their mouths shut. Enjoy their retirement. Somebody like Billy Graham has so much to live for. This guy should have died a decade ago. And he's still going. Probably not for much longer, but he's still going. Why waste all of your energy on all this negative stuff and go out there and do interviews and talk shit about people? Just live the rest of your days, however many days that there are. It's not worth wasting your energy with all this hatred and all this animosity. Just sit in your rocking chair on your porch, enjoy the rest of your days, and when the day comes that you finally kick the bucket and you get buried 6 feet under, everybody will say all these wonderful things about you, because that's what people do when somebody dies, right? Even if you don't like the person, everybody has to say something good about them, and they'll say it, and then 6 months later, people will forget about you. So that would be my message to Billy Graham and Larry Zbyszko. Don't waste your energy. Live out the rest of your days. Go golfing. If you're Billy Graham, he likes to paint and shit. Do your little paintings. Sit under the stars at night with your wife and just shut the fuck up. I caught the Hall of Fame special on USA. It was actually a 4-hour block of WWE programming. And this is the first time they aired the Hall of Fame prior to Raw on a Monday night. Typically, they've done it before the actual day of the event. They've had to rush to finish the show so they can get an edited version on TV by 11 o'clock on Saturday night, which, first of all, Saturday night is an awful night for TV. But it also is having a really negative impact on the Hall of Fame ceremony itself. And people for years, even Jim Ross, implored the company, do the Hall of Fame on Friday if you're going to air it on Saturday. And what they went ahead and did instead, USA gave them a clearance before Raw, because I think they wanted a 4-hour block of programming. And what we got was a much improved version of the Hall of Fame. You would never know it by watching the TV special, because everything was completely edited and butchered, and it was very apparent watching it. But from what I read from people who were at the Hall of Fame and such, the ceremony was actually much improved over the way it was in recent years. And again, I would say for the people who are bitching, I saw some of those people on my own Facebook page, that the Hall of Fame speeches were all of, they were all 5 minutes again, and it sucked, and this and that. It was an edited 1-hour version, just like it is every single year. The actual Hall of Fame, the main inductees had much more time to speak. You know, apparently Road Warrior Animal talked for almost 20 minutes. And Shawn Michaels also got plenty of time. I think about the same amount of time for his speech as well, even though he spoke very little about his career. He chose not to. They want you to buy the DVD. There's going to be two versions of WrestleMania that come out on DVD. Maybe three versions. But you'll have a two-disc version that has just the pay-per-view. And they always have a three-disc collector's edition that has the pay-per-view plus a disc with the full Hall of Fame ceremony. It's been this way for years. I don't know why people are so surprised by this. And this has been the case for the last, 6 years now. Nothing has changed. So, as far as the TV version is concerned, the one change that was made, Sunny, her induction was supposed to be shown with Shawn Michaels and the Road Warriors. And apparently, I don't know if it was a USA Network call. I think it was maybe part of the deal in bringing Drew Carey in for that celebrity induction. They wanted to use it to promote his new TV show on the Game Show Network. But Sonny's induction got bumped off the TV special in favor of Drew Carey's, who he was inducted by Kane, who was forced as part of his intro speech, by the way, to promote Drew Carey's new TV show. So that was completely tacky. And Drew Carey's induction, the TV version, literally went 90 seconds. I mean, I might actually be overestimating the amount of time that he spoke on TV. It was a complete waste of time. The speeches were butchered, like I said. Even so, the Triple H induction of Shawn Michaels, and he had this great crack at Hulk Hogan, saying that basically Shawn was in denial about joining the Hulk Hogan Hair Club. I thought that was great. It really hit me, though, watching Shawn Michaels doing his speech, that most of the stars from my childhood are gone. You know, I mean, it's just, it's one of those things where, I mean, I grew up on these guys. You know, when Steve Austin went into the Hall of Fame, it was different. I didn't really grow up with Steve Austin. Wrestling got hot during the Austin era, and I look back on those years fondly. But, I mean, you grow up on people like Hogan and Savage and Warrior and Shawn Michaels and Bret Hart and The Undertaker. As far as WWF is concerned, now, if you grew up an NWA fan or a WCW fan, you probably grew up with Flair and Steamboat and The Horseman and Dusty Rhodes and Terry Funk and Ricky Steamboat and Vader and all of those guys. And a lot of them are gone, too. And now that Shawn is gone, it's you know, we've seen a lot of guys recently, in recent years, you know, and there's going to be more. Undertaker ain't going to be around forever. Triple H is not going to be wrestling forever. You know, I'm sure we'll see those guys like Mick Foley and The Rock, perhaps next year will go into the Hall of Fame. And I don't know, it just hit me. It just, it doesn't mean that I'm going to stop watching or anything, but it just, it was a revelation that hit me in watching him do his speech. Nice little curtain call with the click at the end of the show. They trotted Kevin Nash and Sean Waltman out there, and there was one person conspicuous by his absence. I'm going to get to him in a little bit. So then we had Monday Night Raw, and I'll touch on just some of the key things from this show. First of all, we had Jim Ross and Jerry Lawler reunited yet again for the second night in a row for seemingly one final night on Raw. I knew something was up when they went on the air with these two. I knew JR wasn't going to make it through the night. Thankfully, even though he was embarrassed, at least he didn't get beaten up. I thought for sure JR was getting his ass kicked. Now, I will say this about Jim Ross. He was fantastic at WrestleMania. And as far as Raw goes, he was okay. I thought he was a little shaky at certain points. He was mumbling over some words, and he just didn't seem like he was on his A-game. And I could totally give him a pass on that, though, because apparently he was first informed at 6 p.m. on Monday that they needed him on the show. He didn't even know until 3 hours before the show that he was going to be on the show. So I give him a pass on that. He's still light years better than Michael Cole, don't get me wrong. The Steve Austin segment with the Tough Enough kids, I thought it was great when the crowd was chanting, "Stun them all." That was my first thought, too. Would have been great, actually, if you would have lined them up one by one and just, you know, just gave each one a stunner and see how each one bumps off of it. He confronted The Miz, who came out. He couldn't wrestle because he was he was concussed from the night before. But Miz was actually great here. He got in the ring, and one of the Tough Enough kids is this this big guy who's got this big, like, afro. He's got this big puffed-out hairdo, and Miz called him Buckwheat and told him to get out of the way, and I thought that was great. So Austin, I think Miz took a shot at him, and then Alex Riley came in and started beating up Austin, and we almost got a little mini Steve Austin match. This is like the closest thing to a Stone Cold Steve Austin match that we've gotten since 2003. And he gave Alex Riley some offense, and then he reversed it, and he stomped the mud hole in him in the corner and threw him into the ropes and gave him the Fez press, and then he gave him a stunner, and he looked great in there. You know, I totally believe Austin when he says that if he wanted to wrestle again, he could easily do so. I fully not only endorse the idea, but I believe him when he says that. Booker T, actually, I made a note here. Booker T had a great remark. I don't know if he was referring to Rima Faki, the Miss USA person, or one of the other women on the show from the Tough Enough Kids. I shouldn't say kids, but the Tough Enough crew. The camera was on her, and he made this remark. He said that he would like to sop her up with a biscuit. I've seen a few women, I would say, that in bars about that, too. I'm not sure if that's the beer goggles talking, though, but I thought that was great. Sin Cara debuted on Raw as well. I thought they led us to believe he was going to be in a match this week, but it was an appearance. Sheamus beat Daniel Bryan in the match from WrestleMania that we didn't get. It was actually not a good match. It's the first, I wouldn't call it a bad match, but it was probably my least favorite Daniel Bryan match on Raw yet. And Sheamus basically just, you know, beat him up. 1, 2, 3, and Sin Cara came out. His debut was fine. I saw people bitching that he botched something. I don't think he botched anything. I mean, he bounced off a little trampoline. He got caught up a little bit in the top rope, but he got into the ring fine. You know, to me, a botch is if he would have done that and didn't clear the top rope, where he got tangled in the ropes. I mean, that would have been embarrassing. So anyway, quit bitching. He did perfectly fine. He had a great showing for himself. And he showed up on SmackDown as well, had another great showing, coming out to beat up Jack Swagger. So, you know, leaves open the question of what brand is going to recruit him. And, again, he's supposed to be in some tag matches with Evan Bourne on the Raw brand house shows next month. So, it's a pretty good indication of where he'll end up, but it's not carved in stone, and they're leaving it a little bit ambiguous at this point. So then we get John Cena. I've been waiting all week to talk about this. Now, keep in mind that John Cena at WrestleMania, this is WrestleMania, the biggest show of the year, and Cena has done these impassioned speeches before where he talks about how important WrestleMania is to him and to the superstars, and it's the biggest show of the year, and, you know, the showcase of the immortals, and Cena's been in his share of main events at WrestleMania. He's defended titles, he's won championships, and 24 hours earlier at WrestleMania 27, in front of 71,000 people in the Georgia Dome, not only did he lose to The Miz and not win the WWE Championship as he promised his fans he would do, but he was screwed over by The Rock. He was fucked over at WrestleMania the night before. So, what does he do? Why, of course, he comes out on Raw the next night with that same goddamn grin on his face that he has every single week when he comes out. He looks absolutely overjoyed at the fact that he was screwed out of the championship in the main event of WrestleMania the night before. I you know, can you picture, now there were times in the late 90s when, for example, you know, McMahon was doing everything in his power to screw over Steve Austin. I mean, he came up with every conceivable plan to get the belt off of Stone Cold Steve Austin and just completely screw him and get him out of his company. Or not even get him out of his company, but just make sure that he was kept away from the championship. And one time McMahon was actually successful. You know, McMahon booked Austin in a triple threat match with Undertaker and Kane at the Breakdown pay-per-view. I remember it like it was yesterday. It was September of 1998. And Kane and Undertaker got a double pin on Austin, so nobody knew exactly who the champion was, but Austin lost the title. And McMahon came out, and he grabbed the Smoking Skull belt, and he ran off with it. So this would be the equivalent of the next night on Raw, which I think might have been in Pittsburgh. If Steve Austin would have come out the very next night, smiling and all jovial, seemingly nonplussed about the fact that he had been screwed out of the championship by his boss the night before. In fact, what ended up happening was Steve Austin was fucking pissed off that Vince McMahon had screwed him over. And how did he react to this? Well, he drove a Zamboni to the ring. He actually drove a piece of machinery. Not only did he drive it to the ring, he actually drove it into the ring. And he moved the ring about 6 inches. And he climbed on top of the Zamboni. And he leapt off of the vehicle, over the top rope, into the ring, and attacked Vince McMahon and proceeded to beat the shit out of him. And cops had to restrain him. They could barely restrain this man. He was just filled with rage, and the crowd was chanting his name, and Austin was cursing up a storm, and he was handcuffed, and he was trying to kick and claw at McMahon. This man wanted to kill this person. That's how he reacted when he got screwed out of the title at a meaningless B-show pay-per-view. Not John Cena. No, no, no. See, John Cena loses at WrestleMania, comes out. He is the happiest man in the world. You would never, ever know if you watched him come out on Raw Monday that anything bad had happened to this man a day in his life. You know, he reminds me of like, the Manchurian Candidate. He's just a drone. He's like this programmable cyborg that just is brainwashed to go out there and do whatever he's told to do. You know, go out there and smile for the fans. All right, no problem. So he comes out, and as soon as he started smiling, I couldn't take a single word out of his mouth seriously. And he goes on to talk about The Miz and how he has a newfound respect for The Miz, which, all right, I don't know what The Miz did to earn your respect, but if you say so. And The Rock eventually comes out and has, you know, his face-to-face with Cena, and they did what I would not have done. They basically had The Rock admit that he has respect for John Cena. The fans booed this, by the way. And then, thankfully, he kind of sort of saved it a little bit when he said, even so, I don't like you. And then the fans cheered. I wouldn't have had Rocco out there and give Cena props at all. I would have kept this going that I don't respect you. I don't like you. You talk shit about me. You beat me up last week. I beat you up last night. How's it feel, bitch? I mean, that's basically what The Rock should have come out and said. And one thing led to another. Cena wanted a match. Rock said, all right, I'm cool with that. I'll give you a match. But this is a match that's worthy of the grandest stage of them all. And he said to Cena that, I'll face you in a match one-on-one next year at WrestleMania 28. And, of course, the fans were not thrilled with this because if you're in the building that night, I think it was the Phillips Arena, you want to see these guys beat each other up now, even if it's not in an official match. Not only were they not going to get a brawl between these two guys after what happened the night before, but now we're going to have to wait an entire 12 months to get a wrestling match. So they weren't all that happy about it. And inexplicably, they sent the core out there. I mean, you talk about the most random wrestling run-in that I've seen in a long time. I mean, it's, you know, forget the fact that the core are SmackDown stars, but why are they running out here? I don't know. Obviously, they wanted, I guess, Rock and Cena to clean house, and they didn't want to bury The Miz anymore. I don't know why. They bury him at every opportunity anyway. I guess because he was concussed. So they beat up the core, and we saw Rock Bottom and a people's elbow, and Rock and Cena ended this by shaking hands. So again, I would not have done that. You could have a stare down between them like Rock and Hogan had back in 2002. You know, Hogan did extend his hand. The Rock grabbed Hogan's hand. Hogan went to leave. Rock held on and gave him a Rock Bottom. So again, if you didn't do the big pull-apart brawl that I talked about earlier at WrestleMania, you could have done it last night. I would not have had The Rock say that I have respect for you and then shake the guy's hand. I would have handled that a little bit differently. So for the first time ever, it's kind of an interesting situation because WWE has never officially announced a WrestleMania main event this far in advance. I answered a question in the latest SC Scoops mailbag, which I posted it a little later than usual. The mailbag went up actually this morning, so if you haven't seen it yet, go on the website and read it. First question on there is somebody who wrote in with great concern about WWE taking a big risk by announcing this match so far in advance. And it's a risk. I mean, it's certainly a risk. It would be a risk if they announced this match in a month for the next pay-per-view. What if Cena comes out on Raw next week and breaks an arm? I mean, anything can happen. What if The Rock is you know, he's in the gym and drops a dumbbell on his head? Shit happens. And I told this person, don't freak out. Everything in the end will work out. I mean, at the end of the day, these two guys will have a match. It will be at WrestleMania. If Cena gets hurt, if somebody gets hurt, well, they'll slot somebody else in. You can't worry about that now. You worry about that when we get closer. As far as promoting it that far in advance, you know, I gave an example in the mailbag that even though they didn't officially announce the match a year in advance, they basically did the same thing with Hulk Hogan and Randy Savage. You know, they built up that whole Mega Powers thing for months before Savage even won the title. And, you know, that whole scene of Savage winning the belt at Trump Plaza and, you know, in the ring with Elizabeth and Hogan celebrating at the end of WrestleMania 4, it was clearly a setup. You knew whether it was going to be face versus face or heel versus face that they were building to Hogan versus Savage. And that's exactly what they did. And it was actually one of the all-time great angles and storylines the company ever did, which I think I've mentioned before, supposedly, as folklore has it, it was all the idea of Elizabeth. Elizabeth had this idea for the Mega Powers and the inevitable breakup because of her and the jealousy and all that. So it was great stuff. The fact is they've kind of done it before. And it's uncharted territory for them to do something like that now. Vince McMahon, this is a company that books on the fly. And they now have booked a WrestleMania main event that they cannot get out of a year in advance. I mean, they are already promoting WrestleMania 28. I saw a commercial on USA Network. I don't know what the fuck I was watching, but they were already airing a commercial on USA the other day for WrestleMania 28 in Miami. So, if they have a plan where they're going to try a little bit of an experiment here, and they're going to promote the match and promote the show actively every single month in the lead-up to April 1st of next year, well, good luck. I hope it works. Maybe they'll do over 1 million buys next year if they can promote this match the right way. I don't know. After seeing some of the finishes to these matches and the layouts and everything at WrestleMania this past week, my faith has faltered a little bit in this company. But I actually think that everything will turn out just fine. I'm looking forward to this match. It really is the kind of match that belongs on a WrestleMania show. You know, we talked about maybe they could do it at SummerSlam, and they could have. They could have done it at SummerSlam and make SummerSlam a really big show in Los Angeles. But Rock vs. Cena is one of the few realistic, fantasy matches that you could possibly do. If Steve Austin ain't going to come back and have a match with CM Punk, then, and even so, if he did, I still don't think it would be as big as Rock vs. Cena. It's the biggest match of its kind between two legends that you could do. You know, you're not going to get that Hogan versus Austin match that people talked about for years. We saw Rock and Hogan 10 years ago, and it was great for what it was. Beyond that, what else do you really have? You know, we saw Bret Hart come back last year and have a match with Vince McMahon, which I thought I'd never live to see the day. And that turned out to be not quite what I had expected and hoped it would be. But Rock vs. Cena has money written all over it, and it's truly a WrestleMania-worthy match. I'm excited for it, and I think that they've got the right idea if the plan is to do promotion for the show each month in the lead-up to it. And for the people who are concerned that it's going to lose steam and people aren't going to care about it, it's true. You know what? It is possible that they drop the ball, The Rock vanishes from television and doesn't reappear again until maybe the Royal Rumble. That would be really idiotic on their part if they did that. How difficult would it be if, you know, to get together with The Rock and say, listen, we want to keep the anticipation for this match alive. So every few months between now and then, maybe, you know, the beginning of the summer, maybe is the next time we see Rock in the form of these taped vignettes showing him in his gym. You know, he's always posting pictures of himself on Twitter and Facebook with his headphones in, training at the gym. Put together a little video of him training at the gym and then, you know, turning to the camera and cutting a promo on John Cena. You can have Cena do some promos. You're going to have to rely on the promos. You can't put the two of them together physically between now and then. And Brock probably is not going to be around much, if at all, to actually show up in the building. But if you can do these taped promos and vignettes a couple of more times between now and the end of the year, I think that would be fine. I really do. But I don't know that that's what they have in mind. And actually, I'm a little concerned, only because I don't know that they know where they're going with this. Apparently, there was a huge last-minute rewrite of Raw on Monday. I mean, the early afternoon, the idea was, apparently, Undertaker versus Triple H would take place at SummerSlam. The rematch would happen this year at SummerSlam. And Undertaker would then be available to face John Cena at WrestleMania next year when he tries to go 20-0. That's the idea that I've been crowing about now for months, that John Cena is the ideal opponent for The Undertaker when he tries to go 20-0 at WrestleMania. And obviously, if they're building to Rock vs. Cena, that would eliminate the possibility of Undertaker vs. Cena in Miami next year. So anyway, the point of all this is, that was the original plan on Monday. And then a couple of hours later, they made the Rock vs. Cena announcement for WrestleMania 28. What changed in those couple of hours? Vince McMahon he's getting worse. I mean, could you just imagine if you were on the creative team having to work for this man? I mean, these days when he's this bad, constantly changing his mind and rewriting this and rewriting that just hours before the show. I mean, this is almost Nitro-level bad, these stories, where they would... Well, not quite, though. I mean, Nitro, back in the day, there were, I mean, stories about them going on the air, and the script for the show wasn't even finished. And the show was already on the air. So they haven't quite reached that level yet, but apparently there was just a massive amount of drama backstage on Monday, and Rock vs. Cena was not the original plan for Mania 28. So something changed along the way. I'm not quite sure what that was. And for everybody who's assuming, based on Triple H's promo, that it will be Undertaker versus Triple H in a rematch next year, I'm not saying it can happen. It could very well happen. Triple H never said that. Triple H, all he said was he does not believe that we have seen The Undertaker's last match. None of us believe that. And when The Undertaker is ready to return, Triple H said that he'll be waiting. That doesn't mean WrestleMania next year. That could very easily mean SummerSlam this year. So I just wanted to put that out there. Some people were assuming he meant WrestleMania. He did not say anything about WrestleMania. They could wait. They could do it next year. I wouldn't. I think they had a phenomenal match last Sunday, but I don't want to see Undertaker face Triple H again. I want a fresh opponent for him when he goes 20-0. I don't want to see the same thing twice. We saw the same thing twice with Shawn Michaels, which was fine because he's Shawn fucking Michaels. And Triple H said it himself on Raw 2 weeks ago. He's not Shawn Michaels. Nobody is. They had a great match. Leave it alone. Come up with somebody new. Maybe next year they can broker a deal finally to bring Sting in. They could do the Undertaker-Sting match next year. Anyway, I keep going back to John Cena. This fucking guy coming out there the way he came out there on Raw last week. I mean, he's obviously going to challenge The Miz again, probably at the next pay-per-view, I'm guessing, for the WWE Championship. How in God's name are we supposed to take him seriously as a title contender when he does not give a fuck about the fact that he got screwed over at WrestleMania? I mean, the title means that much to him that he can come out all smiles and be more concerned about The Rock than the fact that he was cheated out of his, I guess what, would have been his 10th championship or his 11th championship. I mean, how are we supposed to, why does the title mean anything to him? Why does it mean anything? Why does he need it? He's already won it 8 times, 9 times. He obviously doesn't give a shit. That's why nobody takes him seriously as a contender. Nobody cares. Show some emotion. You know how they say turn that frown upside down? That's like a famous expression. No! I want to see a frown. Reverse! I want to see a frown. On a happier note, when Raw went off the air, we got the premiere edition of Tough Enough. This is Tough Enough, the 2011 version. I was a big fan of the original Tough Enough on MTV, which was produced by MTV, not Kevin Dunn and his production team, which is great. They do phenomenal work. But WWE has their own way of doing TV. And it's refreshing when you kind of take WWE, essentially, and put it in a different element. The show, just the way the show is filmed, the way it flows, it's very different than the way WWE does television. And the best thing I could say about the new Tough Enough is that this is the show that I expected the original NXT to be. I fucking love this show. I thoroughly enjoyed it. And I will watch this show every single week that it is on. It wasn't a perfect show, but you needed that drama, I think, in the house, which, I will say this, it's the first episode. They just got into the house, and all of a sudden, some of the guys are clashing with some of the girls. Keep in mind, this is reality TV, which means it's not really based completely in reality. I'm sure this is, certain parts are scripted, certain parts are not necessarily scripted, but it's set up in such a way where they know that by putting these two people together because they don't like each other, that bad things will probably happen. So I'm sure that was part of what we saw in this first episode, but I loved it. I mean, there's scripted drama, but this is par for the course with any so-called reality TV show these days. The other thing about it is, who would have ever thought that we would get a Yokozuna reference on this show? You know, when Austin told that story about crapping his pants in a match with Yokozuna in South Africa, which I imagine probably happened. I mean, if I'm Steve Austin, if I'm anybody, really, I mean, why would you lie about something like that? I could think of a million other tall tales to tell, but why, if it never actually happened, would you tell people that you crapped your pants in a match? So, unfortunately, we can't ask Yokozuna if that actually happened, but, that was just bizarre that his, of all people, he would be name-dropped on this show, in the first episode, no less. Clearly, Steve Austin is the best part of this entire show. His reaction to Ariane saying that Melina versus Alicia Fox was her favorite match, and the only match, apparently, that she ever saw in her life, was fucking priceless. It was the best part of the entire episode. I found, like, three different animated GIF images of Austin's reaction, and I sat there for minutes on end just watching it loop over and over and over again. It was great. The other thing that struck me was at the end of the episode, basically the way it works is, you know, Steve Austin is the host and kind of the taskmaster, and you've got Booker T, Trish Stratus, and Bill DeMott, the former Hugh Morris of WCW fame, as the actual trainers. And at the end of each episode, they take three people who were the three worst performers at that point in time, and they tell them to report back to the gym, the training center where the ring is, and bring their belts with them. Because, you see, each of the contestants is given their own spinner WWE championship belt. They're given a replica. And it's almost like the old Survivor, where you have your torch, and when you get eliminated, they extinguish the torch. I don't know if it still works that way. I don't even know if Survivor is still on the air, but it used to work that way. So they're standing there, you know, with their belt, and Austin basically is, you know, tearing into them, and he wants them to essentially tell him, excuse me, convince him, cut a promo in front of him about why they think they deserve to be here. And Ariane, once she mentioned Melina versus Alicia Fox as her favorite match, I knew that was the end of her. I mean, really? You're going to say, look, I understand that if you have some degree of wrestling knowledge and you are face-to-face with Stone Cold Steve Austin, you don't necessarily want to come across as a kiss-ass. So I wouldn't turn around and say, oh, well, my favorite match of all time is, you know, Steve Austin versus Bret Hart, or it's Steve Austin against The Rock at WrestleMania 17, or, you know, because Austin would probably turn around and basically tear you a new asshole for kissing his ass. So you can't think of a single other match. Not one. You can't even just say Hulk Hogan against, you know, Hulk Hogan and Andre the Giant. You can't think of a single match. Really? It was curtains for her at that point. And she was eliminated. What really didn't look right to me at all, when you are eliminated, you have to give your belt back to Steve Austin. And in his office, Austin has a belt hanger, and he'll kind of hang the person's belt up. And I guess that's the way it'll work in future episodes. So when Ariane gave him the belt, we saw Austin standing there with the spinner belt draped over his shoulder. And I got to tell you, it didn't look right at all. Steve Austin with that spinner belt over his shoulder looked just wrong. It just seemed flat out wrong. Unfortunately, if she is to be believed, Ariane Andrews is her name, she was eliminated, but she announced on her Twitter this past week that she has in fact signed a WWE developmental deal. After all, and will start in Florida Championship Wrestling this upcoming week. She said, quote, "Might have lost, but I got what everyone wanted, a contract with the WWE. I said you will see me again, and you will. I start FCW next week." So I have, you know, no reason to doubt her, I guess, when she says that. And some people will say, well, then what's the point of the show? Listen, a lot of these people are going to get contracts at the end. That's just the way it works. The thing is, whoever wins the show will probably, I don't know if you get a prize. I don't know if it's just a contract or if you get purse money. I think it's just a contract. But the thing is, whoever wins the show, that's the person who's going to come out of this, hopefully, as the big star. That's the person coming out of this who's going to have the Steve Austin stamp of approval, as he says, and will be pushed as a big star. And at that point, it's up to them and I guess the political forces behind the scenes whether or not they actually do become a big star. But a lot of these people are independent wrestlers. I mean, not all of them, but these are in many respects indie workers who already have had some level of training, and they will have exposure on TV from the show. So you knew that was going to happen. You knew a lot of these people were going to get contract offers. But she is just so fucking terrible, and she's got that piss poor attitude, and she couldn't name a single fucking match beyond Melina and Alicia Fox, that she is the last person on this crew that I would have offered a contract to. So if that's true, that's kind of depressing. The initial episode pulled a 2.6 rating for its 11 o'clock airing, which is excellent. And it actually did pretty well on replay airings as well. So the real test will be in about 3 or 4 weeks when the show is going to be moving, of course, this Monday. Don't forget, 8 p.m. before Raw. I think they're replaying it after Raw as well. And we'll see in a couple of weeks how it's doing in its normal time slot. I think I talked about this a couple of months ago when I first talked about the news of Tough Enough coming back and that it was going to air before Raw. It's going to be tough, you know, having 3 hours, essentially, of WWE on TV every Monday for the next 9 or 10 weeks. You know, what happens if, let's say, in my case, if I miss part of the entire episode before Raw goes on? Because, you know, in my case, I get home from work kind of late, and I have to eat, I have shit that I have to do, and I'm usually trying to get all of it done before Raw goes on the air. Now there's a TV show before Raw. Do I wait and watch the replay after Raw goes off the air? Well, true, I could do that, but you're almost guaranteed that during Raw they're going to air commercials for next week's episode and essentially spoil things that happened on the episode that aired that night. So with somebody like me, probably one of the last 7 people in the entire world who doesn't have DVR, it could complicate things. That kind of sucks, but I'm looking forward to the show. I really enjoyed it. The people on Facebook, the people who have emailed, who have complained about the show, they said it sucked and all this, and oh, you know, all the drama in the house. That's reality TV. You have to take the good with the bad, you know. They're banking on the drama for ratings. You know, without the ratings, it's just another, without the drama, rather, it's just another wrestling show. I really enjoyed it. If you haven't seen the show, you owe it to yourself to at least check out the first episode. It may not be everyone's cup of tea. I was very skeptical going into the show. You know, it's not a perfect show, but at the end of the day, I was entertained for an hour. You know, when the show was over a little after midnight, I was actually kind of disappointed that it was over, and that's usually a good sign. So, thumbs up for the premiere of Tough Enough. I've got high hopes for the shows coming up in the future. They're going to have John Cena on the show this week. I'm sure he'll be smiling, as he always does. They're going to have The Rock. Stacey Keibler, I think, has commented she spilled the beans, perhaps by accident, in an interview that she did recently, that she would be on Tough Enough. I assume she meant as a guest and not a contestant, so we'll see if she shows up. The Big Show, Rey Mysterio. I'm hoping Triple H shows up in one of these episodes. Anybody who remembers the infamous Triple H rant, the verbal assault that he levied on those kids from the first Tough Enough show when he came on, because Triple H really was against the idea of Tough Enough in its first incarnation. He thought that it really exposed the business. He was not a fan of it. I would imagine he probably isn't the biggest fan of this either. But it's just an all-time classic promo, essentially, that he cut on the members of that first Tough Enough crew. And I saw that first episode recently. I watched it online. I don't remember where it was, but it was great. I'd love to see him back on the show this time. Well, we got to talk about Scott Hall now, unfortunately. I'm sure by now all of you have pretty much heard about the debacle that occurred on Friday night. There was an iPay-per-view taping for an independent promotion called Top Rope Promotions in Fall River, Massachusetts. And Scott Hall was supposed to appear on the show. And unfortunately, in the days leading up to the show, there were a lot of conflicting news reports that he had suffered a drug overdose and was rushed to the hospital. There were other reports. For a brief time, his Wikipedia page reflected the fact that he had died. And that was never able to be confirmed, obviously, because he, in fact, did not die. But let's just say that Scott Hall had some sort of episode. It's still unclear exactly what that was. His publicist said that he was suffering from low blood pressure. There was perhaps some sort of troublesome mix of medications that he had been on. He has some cardiac issues, and the medications just mixed, and they didn't react well to each other. And other people will say that he, in fact, did suffer some sort of drug overdose. Knowing his history, it's hard to take... Listen, I'm a PR guy, and I'll tell you right off the bat, the publicist does what the client wants them to do. The publicist is not there to tell the truth. The publicist is there to protect the client in any way, shape, or form. And if they feel they can't do that, they usually will recuse themselves. Hence what happened in the case of Charlie Sheen, who, of course, you know, I say to myself sometimes when Charlie Sheen was going on all those benders, and it just seemed to be getting progressively worse and worse and worse. In one respect, I would have loved to have been Charlie Sheen's PR rep. I just think it would have been the coolest job in the world for about 48 hours. And then after that, I would have wanted to blow my brains out. even his longtime publicist had to just step aside because things just got to be too much. And so just take whatever the publicist says with a grain of salt. He didn't need me to tell you that, but I'm just putting it out there anyway. So Hall showed up for the Top Rope Promotions event. He probably, you know, probably needed the money, I'm guessing. And I think he was also doing it as a favor to his buddy, Justin Credible, who was on the show. And I don't know that Justin Credible has ever really been considered officially part of the, quote, clique. But he's always been friends with Hall and Nash and Michaels. And he was, you know, he was friendly with that whole group even going back to the mid-90s. So he was there, and Hall, I guess, was there to work with him. And he showed up in a bad, bad state. He looked like hell warmed over. And he was under the influence of something. Nobody could really tell what it was, if it was alcohol, if it was drugs, if it was prescription medication. Oh, by the way, another story supposedly was also that he suffered a seizure. So take your pick. He either has cardiac issues, suffered a seizure, had a bad mix of medications, or a voluntary drug overdose. Take your pick as far as what it was. But he showed up. He was in a bad way. And there was an autograph signing before the show. And apparently he fell asleep during the autograph signing. And when he was awake, his signature consisted not of his name, but just a line that he drew on the page. That'll be worth something someday. Scotty Too Hotty, who wrestled on the show that night, former WWE superstar Scotty Too Hotty, he even took to Twitter that night after the event and wrote, quote, "Just witnessed the saddest, most embarrassing thing in my career. How many guys have to die before some guys learn?" End quote. If Scotty Too Hotty took to Twitter to say that, you know that he saw something bad. The people who run the promotion actually had this to say. They say, quote, "Unfortunately, Top Rope Promotions does not own the footage of the incident. The iPay-per-view company does. And they plan on running the iPay-per-view as scheduled with Scott Hall's segment intact. And in fact, let me just stop there for a second. I could say that that iPay-per-view, I believe, is airing tonight, probably within the hour here that I'm recording this podcast. And the company, the iPay-per-view company that is offering the event, is not only including the Scott Hall footage in the show, despite requests from Scott Hall and the actual wrestling company to not do so, they're doing it anyway. And they're actually promoting it around Scott Hall's appearance. They're using his appearance and all of the controversy that it has caused to try to sell some iPay-per-view buys. And they put a press release out. Apparently some of the wrestling sites have refused to run it. It's just a matter of taste, really. Yes, there is even taste in the wrestling industry. Obviously, this is sickening. I don't really, you know, that's the easiest word to use. But let me just finish this quote here from the wrestling promotion. They said that they would like to issue an apology, and they actually are urging fans not to order the iPay-per-view, as the Scott Hall footage is disturbing. He needed several people to help him get in and out of the ring. He even fell over in the ring. Please pray for the guy. We wish him the best. End quote. There's something you don't hear every day. The wrestling company, and maybe they don't get a cut of the pay-per-view, so they don't care, but they're actually urging people not to order the show because they feel the footage of Hall is just too disturbing. And the footage of Hall, by the way, is widely available on YouTube. And there's a couple of different versions. The actual full segment, as shot seemingly from a fan cam, is on YouTube. It's about 13 minutes long, and there's been some more succinct clips that are a little bit easier to watch, a little clearer, even more sad, of Scott Hall backstage before he came out. He is clearly drugged up on something. I've never seen it this bad before. I mean, Scott Hall has had tons of incidents over the years, and you know, he may have looked bad at show or slurred his speech. I have never seen him look this bad in public before. And he was in the ring. He was completely unintelligible on the microphone. There's nothing more sad than a guy coming out as Scott Hall was doing. And again, he could barely move. He's being helped by three different people. And as his Wolfpack music is playing, he pauses to do some crotch chops. I mean, there is nothing more uncool than that. It's pathetic, is what it is. You know, Hall was supposed to be in rehab. Hall stated that he would not be going to the WWE Hall of Fame to be with Shawn Michaels and Kevin Nash and his good buddies because he didn't want to be in a situation where there would be temptations. You know, Scott Hall, more than drugs, it was always alcohol that Hall was associated with. Nash and Sean Waltman actually hosted a WrestleMania party, I think on Friday night, a couple of days before the show. And it was at a club, and I'm sure the alcohol was flowing. And give a lot of credit to Scott Hall. If that's honestly how he felt, and that wasn't some publicist bullshit, he recognized that that was probably not the right atmosphere for him to be in, and he didn't go. And he was actually supposed to be starting rehab again around this time. And not even so much for alcohol issues, substance issues, but he said in an interview, maybe it was in one of his last Call with Scott Hall videos a while back, that he had been to a therapist recently and had realized he had some deep-seated emotional and mental issues, and he was going to rehab for that. He was going to counseling of some kind for that. Obviously, he didn't, or he did and he left, and this is what we end up with. You know, TMZ jumped all over the story. They've run two or three different stories on this in the last couple of days. They claim that doctors are looking... Hall's in the hospital now, and they claim that they're looking into the various medications that he's taking, supposedly 10 different medications in all for various ailments. You know, to go back to that footage, there's two more disturbing things. First of all, when he's in the ring, Scott Hall used to do this move, even in his Razor Ramon days, where he would punch you twice, and then he would spin around and punch you a third time. It was the discus punch. And he does the discus punch in this video as Just Incredible holds up his opponent for Hall to punch him. And, well, if you watch the video, you'll see it for yourself. Hall stands there and tippy-toes in a circle and then throws the weakest punch you'll ever see. And the guy had a sell for it. You know, he's wearing his hospital bracelet. He's clearly wearing a hospital bracelet in the video. So obviously he was in the hospital and must have checked himself out that day, perhaps, because he still had the bracelet on his wrist. I'm gonna stop here for a second and say this. I see a lot of people bashing Scott Hall. Scott Hall is an embarrassment. Scott Hall should be ashamed of himself. He's a druggie or a drunk. He's an asshole. He's this and he's that. I've heard a lot of people, including wrestlers, say that Scott Hall can be an asshole before. And I'm pretty sure I've ranted on Scott Hall myself before. I know I've ranted on Jake the Snake. I even did a show a couple years ago where I said that I figured Jake was going to be dead within 5 years. And I hope I'm wrong, but I could still be right about that. We haven't hit 5 years yet. Seeing this video of Scott Hall makes Jake the Snake Roberts look like a choir boy. Think about that. Scott Hall is a guy that has issues. And drug issues, substance abuse issues of any kind is a serious thing. And unless you've been through something like that before in your life, and I know that we have people listening to the show now who actually have been through stuff like this before because they've written into me. In some cases, they've written into me before. And I appreciate them doing that. And I you know, wouldn't go on the air and out them or anything, but they've shared their own stories of being through stuff like that. And it's powerful stuff. It's not something that should be made light of. It's not something that should be taken lightly at all. It is a serious disease. It's really a mental illness is what it is. And what we are seeing is the culmination of this mental illness that Scott Hall has. And you can blame Scott Hall. You certainly could. He's a grown adult. He's a 50-something-year-old man. I'm pretty sure he's in his 50s by now. Or just about 50 years old. And he's had opportunity after opportunity after opportunity to clean his act up. He's got friends that care about him. Kevin Nash is probably one of his best friends in the world, and he took to Twitter and he said that Scott, I think, was flying in to stay with him at his home and he was going to try to help him out. He has people that want to see him get better. He's got a ton of fans out there. I mean, there's lots of Razor Ramon fans out there who want to see the bad guy get better. And I'm not going to stand here or sit here and bash Scott Hall, even though he's a grown adult who should know better. I'm going to bash the promotion. And I respect the promotion saying that, you know, we don't think you should order the iPay-per-view, and the company that's offering the pay-per-view is scum and this and that. And they are. They are the scum of the earth. But Top Rope Promotions is no better. Top Rope Promotions should be ashamed of themselves. Because how in God's name do you allow Scott Hall, in the condition that he is in those videos, when he shows up at the building in that state, to even go through the fucking curtain? How does that even happen? And you know that this is being recorded for an internet pay-per-view. It's not just a random indie show that's never going to see the light of day on television. It actually is being recorded for air. And you allow this man, at your 30th anniversary show, whatever the fuck it was, to essentially represent your company. And to go out there when he couldn't even walk to the ring on his own two feet. He needed to be helped to the ring, into the ring, out of the ring, and to the back. He showed up that day, hours earlier, looking like that. He was falling asleep at an autograph signing. It's not like a Jeff Hardy and TNA situation where people claim that he was fine. Jeff Hardy looked perfectly fine all day long, and it wasn't until he was already at the ring and he fell over the ring steps and they called an audible and they ended the match. And I took TNA to task for that too. But this is different. Okay? Nobody in their right mind who saw Scott Hall that day, based on everything that everybody is saying, could have believed that he was anything but fucked up. And they still sent him out there. They allowed him to go out there. I don't care what sort of commitment you had. I don't care if you were concerned because you promised the fans that Scott Hall was going to be there and he was your big attraction and you felt like you had to deliver that to the fans. Do you honestly think that what you delivered to the fans that night was better than what you could have given them if you would have just said to him, you know what, Scott, you're not in the right frame of mind. We're gonna hold you back. We're going to call an audible. There's that expression again. We're going to do something else. We're going to go in a different direction. How difficult would that have been? It is embarrassing, quite frankly. This company claims that this was their 30th anniversary show. I find that hard to believe, but okay, I'll take them at their word. It's hard for me to sit here and believe that a company like this that doesn't have any common sense is operating for 30 years. I find that to be frightening, quite frankly. And I think that they should be ashamed of themselves for putting him out there and allowing him to go out there. I don't care if Scott Hall turned around to you and said, I want to go out there. It doesn't matter. You have the ability to say, listen, we're calling the shots. It's our show. You're fucked up. You're not going out there. And they sent him out there like that. I cannot believe that. A bunch of fucking bottom feeders these people are. Again, substance abuse is a serious issue. It's a day-to-day thing. They say you take it one day at a time. I mean, for God's sakes, I can't sit here and claim that I've ever had substance abuse issues before. The closest thing that I could possibly compare to this, and it's a horrible example, I admit, but for fuck's sake, I used to be addicted to Rice-A-Roni. This has just gone completely off the rails now. But I used to be addicted to fucking chicken Rice-A-Roni. I shit you not. It's delicious. Anybody out there that has never had Rice-A-Roni, chicken Rice-A-Roni, try it. You'll love it. I used to love this stuff. Okay, I would have it every week. I could eat a whole fucking pot by myself. That's how good it was. Do you know how bad Rice-A-Roni is for you? Do you know how much fat, how much sodium is in that shit? For years, I had that stuff. And then one day, 5 years ago, I decided I don't want to have this anymore. This is bad for me. I'm going to stop. And I quit cold turkey. I did not have a morsel of rice from that box in my mouth again for another 4 years. And then last year, on a random day, I was at a family function, and wouldn't you know it, there was a bowl of Rice-A-Roni that had been made and served with the food. And I said to myself, this is not a good idea. Don't do it. But I caved, and I had it anyway. Even though I knew it was wrong, I knew I shouldn't have done it, I couldn't help myself. I did it anyway. I haven't had it since, but I'm pissed at myself about little things like that, that I don't have the simple self-control to stop myself from having a box of fucking chicken Rice-A-Roni, which, by the way, was absolutely magnificent. That's fucking food! That's Rice-A-Roni, for God's sakes! This guy is dealing with drugs and alcohol, really serious shit. I'm willing to cut him some slack. I can get it. I get it. I totally understand it. It's hard. And if you don't have the willpower, then you're going to fall back into old habits, and old habits die hard. But the wrestling promotion in this case doesn't have any excuse whatsoever. I mean, the video of him walking through the curtain, the fact that if I'm the owner of the company, I would tackle his ass to the ground before he sets a shoelace through that curtain. And they let him go out there like that. And that, to me, is a fucking atrocity. And they ought to be ashamed of themselves, and they ought to apologize, quite frankly, to their fans. Don't apologize because the iPay-per-view company is going to run the show and, oh, they're such bad people. Why don't you take a look in the mirror? I want to mention one last thing here before we wrap it up. Not going to have time for a mailbag, unfortunately, but I got a great little message from one of our listeners, and I want to take this opportunity to wish Tim Pace, who is one of the followers of, I guess, of the Sound Off, want to wish Tim a happy birthday, a belated birthday. He turned, well, I won't say what he turned, but he celebrated a birthday this past week, and apparently he's an avid listener of the show, to the point where his lovely wife wrote in to tell me about that and to complain. And this birthday wish is, this birthday message is from myself and Tim's lovely wife, wishing him a happy birthday here on the air. So hopefully he's listening right now, and I just want to say to Tim, if he's listening, I'm sure he is, you've got a great woman. Don't let her go. Not every woman would do that sort of thing, but you're a very lucky man, I will say that. Happy birthday, buddy. If you have a message for the Sala Monster, you can email me directly at thesalamonster, all one word, at gmail.com. You can hit me up on Twitter, twitter.com/salamonster, facebook.com/thesalamonster, as always. You can also subscribe to the show in iTunes. Won't cost you anything. You can leave some love on there, too. Leave a review in iTunes if you wish to do so. I apologize again. No time for the sound off here. No time for the mailbag. I think we have plenty of time for the sound off. 2.5 hours worth. My new record for a single show. So much happening this week. And I'm sure that there will be more to talk about next week. I appreciate all the messages I got. I know people were dying for a new show the day after WrestleMania, the day after Raw. And I would love to do one, but oftentimes, I got to wake up early in the morning or something else intervenes. And if I'm not doing it, you can rest assured there's a very good reason for it. So I thank all of you for hanging in there and for supporting the show. Keep spreading the love. Keep telling people about it. That's the only way we're ever going to grow. And you guys make it happen, and I appreciate it very much. By the way, I got a couple of good ideas for the next couple of weeks for some potential new editorial features and, you know, countdown lists and stuff like that. I do those every now and then for SC Scoops and plan on doing more of them. And wanted to put it out there that if you guys have any particular subject or list or countdown or something that you might like to see on SCScoops.com, you can email me and let me know, and perhaps I will borrow your idea for an editorial in the near future. So if there's anything you want to hear about, see me write about, email me, thesalamonster@gmail.com, and let me know what you think. As always, be well, stay safe, enjoy the rest of your week. We'll see you right back here next weekend. Take it easy, guys.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is Joel from Northern Ireland.
I am AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Sala Monster sounds off on SEScoops.com.